Oh.
Roundabouts.
Good morning. This is the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. The date is Friday, March 16th, for the record. And for the record, we do have quorum. As you know, this is the last day of deadline, so we're going to be going quickly. We're going to try to go quickly through the agenda. We have a long one, and legislators come and go. They've got hearings all over the place. So we're going to change the order up a little bit. Senator Gazelka, Senate File 1912.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, quickly, Senate File 1912 is a bill that seeks to require a physician's presence in the same room with a woman who is getting an abortion. It deals with the pill RU486. But today, before your committee, Mr. Chair, this bill is really here because of the penalties, and I believe there's been some conversation about that, and there may be an amendment offered that would change the reason to be here.
Members, you may remember we had a discussion, was it earlier this week or maybe last week? And so now we're back with it. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, if I do plan to offer an amendment, if this is an appropriate time, I may be called out. So, Mr. Chairman, I have some real concerns about some of the damages provisions in this bill, as well as the criminal penalty portion. I feel that while I am fully supportive of what the bill is attempting to accomplish, I think that the class of people that are allowed to bring suit under the damages provision is too broad. And so I would therefore ask to amend the bill to remove subdivisions 3 through 8. So in other words, the amendment is fairly simple. We would remove lines 2.9 all the way through 3.23, and then obviously the effective date provision, lines 3.24 and 3.25, would stay in. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would move to remove lines 2.9 through 3.23.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none. Senator Thompson moves at 2.9, lines 2.9 through 3.23 be deleted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Is there any other amendments or discussion? Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members, in light of that amendment, I think on lines 3.24 to 3.25, you would want to delete everything after 2012 because there are no longer any causes of actions left in the bill.
3.24 and 3.25.
And actually, Ms. Pontius points out that would be a default effective date anyway, so you might want to delete the whole effective date.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Senator Newman moves that lines 3.24 through 2.5 be deleted. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. We have the bill before us. Is there further discussion? Anyone wish to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Oh, Ms. Jackson, please approach the table.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The American Civil Liberties of Minnesota is funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend constitutional rights under the United States and Minnesota constitutions. Senate File 1912 would impermissibly prohibit the use of telemedicine only in the case of abortion providers who administer RU486 to induce an abortion. The state has a strong interest in protecting women's health. However, Senate File 1912 does not accomplish that goal. According to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, regulation of abortion must not be different from regulation of other similar outpatient procedures. Secondly, the United States Constitution requires that the regulation of early-term abortion must not impose an undue burden on a woman's ability to make the decision to terminate her pregnancy. An undue burden exists, and therefore a provision of law is invalid if its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. As with any medical procedure, the state may enact regulations to further the health or safety of a woman seeking an abortion. Unnecessary health regulations that have the purpose or effect of presenting a substantial obstacle to a woman seeking an abortion impose an undue burden on that right. Testimony was heard in the Health and Human Services Committee outlining the many ways telemedicine is already in use in Minnesota. For example, the Mayo Clinic uses telemedicine to evaluate and treat stroke victims. In our state, there are very few abortion providers, and many women seeking an abortion must travel significant distances in order to reach a provider. Senate File 1912 singles out and prohibits abortion providers from administering RU486 in remote areas of the state via telemedicine. There is no rationale for treating RU486 differently from other similar medical treatment provided via telemedicine. There is simply no other purpose for this provision other than to make it more difficult and expensive. By foreclosing the use of telemedicine in this context, the Senate File 1912 has both the purpose and effect of placing an undue burden on women seeking abortions. Therefore, Senate File 1912 is likely unconstitutional under Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Moreover, the Minnesota Constitution has been held to provide greater privacy protection for a woman's right to choose abortion than is found in the U.S. Constitution. Under Doe v. Gomez, state regulations that infringe on a woman's state constitutional right to privacy in the abortion context are subject to strict scrutiny, something that Senate File 1912 is likely to fail. Therefore, we urge you to vote no on Senate File 1912.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, we're here before you for the civil penalties. Those have all been removed. That's my further discussion.
Our jurisdiction is pretty much erased in this bill. Senator Newman moves Senate File Number 1912 as amended to be recommended to pass. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I know that they took out the penalties. I just want to say that I think this is a bill that's focusing on one industry, one part of the medical profession, and again, it's not a matter of women's safety. I mean, any prescription drug has risks, but prescription risks of RU486 are much less than many other drugs. And as I point out in the Health and Human Services Committee, Viagra is five times the risk of health impact as this drug is. And I'll take this seriously as a bill when somebody introduces a bill to make sure doctors have to be present when Viagra is administered. And I don't think people are proposing that. I understand the bill, this committee's jurisdiction has been pulled from the bill, but I urge people to oppose it.
Thank you. Senator Newman renews his motion that Senate File 1912, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the floor?
The floor.
Further discussion? Not hearing any. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Next on the list is Senator Han in the room. Senator Ingebrigtsen, you are here. That would be Senate File 1839, members. Welcome to the committee, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1839 has to do with game and fish issues, aquatic invasive species specifically. Last year, members, if you remember, I was here with this very same issue where I believe what pertains to this committee is on page 8, subdivision 5, civil penalties. I have with me today Deputy Commissioner Bob Meyer, who will certainly explain this to you, but in essence is what it is, and the reason it ends up in this committee is that we are looking at civil penalties.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, could you point out that reference again? I know that on our summary, we have the specific sections that relate to the committee. And could you give us a page and a section number again?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Section 10 starts on page 6, line 6.11. And we're looking at section 10, 11, and 13, 14, 16, and 17.
Right. All right.
Mr. Chair, I can go through those sections if you so desire.
Why don't we do it that way? Go ahead, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned this is the DNR's policy bill. Section 10 and 11 pertain to aquatic invasive species, specifically zebra mussels. And what Section 10 allows us to do is enter into a delegation agreement with local units of government to help us battle the fight against zebra mussels. What we're trying to do here, and we've been requested to do by watersheds and local units of government, is to allow them to also inspect and decontaminate boats as well. The intent of this section is to make sure that it's done uniformly across the board, that everybody is performing them in the right manner, and that things are working in the right way. We have been working with some stakeholder groups on some changes to this language. We don't have that language here in front of us today, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, but we do recognize this does need a few tweaks, and we will make sure that those do happen on Section 10. Section 11 deals with the civil penalties, and actually, Mr. Chairman, this committee and the Senate last year authorized or voted that these penalties be at this level. In conference committee, the House or the other body, I should say, halved these penalties. So it's our desire to go back. This is an important issue. We want to make sure that the penalties are at the right level. So we are, again, fighting to have these penalties at the levels that are in this bill. Section 13 deals with a technical change. You'll see the language we're striking. We're clarifying that it's a chapter 1923 reference in law, chapter 430, and we're clarifying that on lines 9.29. To be units of the Outdoor Recreation Act, established in 86A. And the gist of this provision, Mr. Chair and members, is that these penalties on the fine charts or the fee schedules with the courts are charged as petty misdemeanors, but in statute they were listed as misdemeanors. So the intent of this section and another section is to clarify that these violations are in fact petty misdemeanors as they're being charged or they're being penalized through the court system. Section 14 is the same thing, Mr. Chairman, related to the horse pass, clarifying that it is a petty misdemeanor. Section 16 is really just a clarification. It's striking the word "the" and inserting "a" on line 11.26. This is a clarification. Some people were under the impression that if they were riding, if they got a DWI on a motorboat, that it was on that specific boat they could not operate again, when in fact the law is, the intent of the law is that if you are in violation of that or found guilty of that violation, you cannot operate any boat. So that's the reason for that language. And then Section 17 is just a clarification on the provision that we have here. If someone does not, if they fail to appear in court, and you can see the new language there on lines 12.9 to 12.10, where if a person is in response to a notice to appear or fails to comply with other orders of the court regarding the appearance proceedings, they would be found in violation. Those are the provisions in front of you today, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer, I have a question on the Section 10. This is in reference to authorizing tribal governments to conduct mandatory inspection. Would this be a permissive or a voluntary request of state government to a tribal government? And are tribal governments, do they have any comment on this?
Mr. Chair, members, this whole section is permissive. It doesn't say that they have to delegate these, that we will delegate these. We just want to be able to. The case in point is Mille Lacs Lake, Mr. Chair. It is infested with zebra mussels. And with the tribe up there, we work very closely, and they want to help us in this fight. So we want to make sure that they're able to do that.
So you would say, Mr. Meyer, that they're cooperatively in favor of this provision?
Mr. Chairman, correct.
Mr. Backus, there was one other reference that we missed earlier?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. There's one little provision that didn't make it into the judiciary-specific summary, and it's Article 1, Section 4. It provides that someone who is convicted of a snowmobile or ATV DWI is prohibited from prohibiting operating any snowmobile or ATV for 1 year. And it's very similar conceptually to the Section 16 that the witness described.
Any discussion? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Backus, that's a technical clarification. I assume nobody intended it to be just the snowmobile they were.
Mr. Chair, members, I would assume that's so, because it wouldn't make too much sense otherwise.
Any other discussion? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Myers, if we could go to page 7 of the bill. Beginning at line 7.4, it looks like the commissioner is being given the authority to set up, how would I say, you know, like roadblocks. That's the wrong way to terminate or to describe it, but it would authorize conservation officers to stop vehicles for the purposes of inspecting to make sure that zebra mussels and these invasive species are not being transported. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, yes, you are. And this would be done in a manner to not. You can see the following section, 7.9 to 7.14, talk about making sure we aren't causing roadblocks and things like this, but this is a huge piece of our fight against the zebra mussels, is making sure that people aren't moving these boats and that they are clean if they are moving them.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Myers, you know, I understand that and I agree with it, and I really do believe that it's important. My concern is, how does this type of a stop play into if a conservation officer during one of these stops for no reason other than an inspection, if the conservation officer sees, you know, marijuana or the driver is drunk or some other criminal activity going on, we are now engaged in stopping citizens for one reason. I just want to make sure that we're not going to step over the line and provide a manner for law enforcement to stop people for no reason. Just want some assurances.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have Colonel Conrad, our head enforcement officer, answer that question.
Colonel, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, Jim Conrad, Director of Enforcement, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And to the question, the purpose of the stops obviously would be for inspection for aquatic invasive species, but any subsequent violation discovered as a part of that stop certainly would be addressed by the law enforcement personnel involved. However, we would not use that as a ruse to try to set up drug stings and that sort of thing. It follows just the same as if a trooper pulls somebody over for speeding and finds marijuana in the car subsequent to that stop. It does not prevent the trooper from taking the appropriate enforcement action for that. So, you know, if an included offense was found, certainly that would we would have to take some sort of action. We couldn't just look past that.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Conrad, I would never want to intimate that you would use this as a ruse to stop people. That is certainly not the direction that I am going in. But by the same token, I would respectfully disagree with you that this is akin to stopping someone for speeding and then discovering a violation after that legal and legitimate stop. My concern is that we are putting law officers in a position where, you know, they have to keep their eyes and their ears open, and if they happen to stumble into a situation where there's clearly a violation of law involved, but the stop was not constitutionally authorized, and all of a sudden we have a citizen now being arrested without a finding of any kind of reasonable basis for the stop in the first place. That's my concern. I absolutely respect and believe in what you're trying to do in stopping these invasive species, but I really question the stops for the purpose of maintaining your war against these invasive species at the expense of what I would view as an illegal stop.
Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Newman in this regard. This is very reminiscent during the early days of kind of the war on drunk drivers when we talked about having DWI checkpoints where you could just check everybody that was driving through without having any articulable traffic violation to justify the stop. This seems to me to be an overreach. It's not based on observation that there is an invasive species or a suspicion of that other than their presence in a particular body of water. And to me, that seems like we're making a stop, which is effectively making a seizure without the requisite constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure. So I do have some problems with this particular part of the language, absent some kind of articulable suspicion or a probable cause.
Mr. Chair.
Colonel.
To address that a little bit further, the way that we are setting these up would be narrowly focused on, first off, vehicles that were either towing or transporting water-related equipment. We wouldn't be stopping just every driver or whatever that's going past. Plus, they would be in locations adjacent to those bodies of water that are either very high activity or very susceptible to the introduction of these specific invasive species or are already infested in order to prevent the transport from that specific body of water to other bodies of water that are not infested already. So we are narrowly focusing our activities there to have the least effect on those people that are not actually taking part in those activities.
Colonel, I think the committee is having a little caution. You may be wanting to implement this narrowly, but the way this is written, it's written generally and broadly. And that's where some of the discomfort is coming. I remember the time when we would have these DWI stops where every car on a road would get pulled over, and I think the Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional.
That is my recollection.
And so if that's true, are we making the same mistake over again, or at least creating a potential for that? Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Conrad and Senator Ingebretson, would it, and this is just a thought, would it help if these, if the commissioner staffs these inspection places with folks other than conservation officers who are licensed police officers, who in my mind are obligated to take action if they see a criminal activity, but if we were to staff this inspection area with folks who are not police officers, not conservation officers, would that help? And it's just a thought.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Senator Newman, for that question. Conservation officers are licensed officers. They have been for some time. And I sense the well, first of all, on the bottom of page 6, you'll see there where we've already have in law the authority for check stations. But I'm sensing a little bit of the let's bring back a little history here way back when there were stops like this, and quite frankly, I come from an era where we would, and it was abused. It quite frankly was abused even before my time. I hear stories about using conservation officers to stop vehicles years and years ago, and that would precipitate a total investigation of everything. We could go into somebody's freezer. We could go into the house. Things that has come a long, long way, Senators. It's come a long way, and that's just not happening anymore. And again, you have the tool here already in place, and I guess I I certainly don't have the CO experience that the colonel has here, but I'm guessing that if a conservation officer is doing one of these stops and sees a large amount of marijuana or sees a whole bunch of juveniles that might be drinking or something like that, my guess is the policy would be to call the local deputy sheriff. They would come over and they would ensue the investigation. And but as far as making, you know, illegally, you know, stopping somebody for no reason at all, quite frankly, they're going to be so busy doing this, they won't, you know, they're just not going to be doing that. I don't think that's going to happen, but they have the authority to do that now. And it's pretty hard to not have some kind of a thing like this, some kind of a check station like this to check water in the live well. I mean, it's as simple as that. That's one way of moving the invasive species. So if you don't pull them over and give them just a general inspection, and a lot of these inspections, I think the colonel will agree, are educational in nature. I mean, that's what's going to come out of most of these. Probably a very small percentage of these are going to end up in arrest. In fact, if you look at the fiscal note here, with the fines we're talking about with this committee today, we're looking at the possibility of $6,000 worth of fines for the year. That isn't a lot of fines. It's not a lot. And they're not expecting to find too many that are going to be in that kind of a violation.
Sir Marty.
Mr. Chair, following up on Senator Newman's thought, I think the idea is instead of using a conservation officer, so the person who is legally required to follow up on any violations they see, what if you were to staff it with non-COs who are just inspectors or something, and then because they have no probable cause, they're doing the education, they're doing the let's drain the live wells, let's clean up the mess and send people on their way. It would be less expensive than conservation officers. And then if they find marijuana or something, they have no – then the stop without probable cause doesn't lead to unconstitutional action. It's simply doing what you want to do, which is clean up the problem. And I'm wondering, and I guess I think Senator Newman's thought of whether, I don't know what you'd call them, inspectors or somebody, and I don't know if DNR has people who could do something like that, but it'd be cheaper, I'd picture.
Mr. Chair, members, if you look at line 7.23, that is exactly what we're trying to do here, employ inspectors that have been trained and authorized by the commissioners. By the commissioner, this war that we're fighting on zebra mussels, we can't fight it ourselves. We fully recognize that. That's why we want to be able to delegate it to licensed peace officers. We want to train inspectors. Actually, we have a level 2 inspector workforce coming on this year that will have several hundred of these people not licensed, but trained and employed by the DNR, rather than our college interns doing the aquatic milfoil, aquatic plant inspectors. These will be more sophisticated, more advanced people looking for the zebra mussels and working with folks on a one-on-one educational opportunity, also just enforcement inspection, looking at the boats, making sure they are clean, but also telling people, hey, you need to drain your water. Make sure if you have a boat lift, make sure you aren't moving that. Make sure it's clean and dry and things like that. It's impossible to clean a lake once these animals, these creatures get into them, and the impacts are devastating. So we need to do whatever we can as soon as possible to stop those impacts.
So, Mr. Meyer, it would be the commissioner's intent and your intent that we would be utilizing, and I didn't see this before, the inspectors that have been trained, that those are the folks that are going to be at these inspection stations, not necessarily conservation officers. Am I correct on that, Colonel?
Mr. Chair, members, there'll be a mix. I mean, we will have certified inspectors, and then if there is a violation, we will need to call in a licensed peace officer to deal with that if there is some kind of violation of law. These folks won't have any enforcement authority.
Senator Newman?
The violation of law, Mr. Meyer, that you're talking about is the violation of the inspection in this bill. You are not talking about other violations. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chairman, the inspectors would be looking for aquatic invasive species violations.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either one of the testifiers, I have a constituent who's actually a conservation officer, and so after the Aquatic Invasive Species Summit that I participated in January, I called him and I asked him about, you know, some of the requests that were made there and obviously what's been a result of that. And his concern, and I'm in favor of some of this, but I have concerns. One of the things he said is, number one, most conservation officers don't want to be aquatic invasive species police. But he also said that they are also trained so that they don't violate people's civil liberties. And so that's when you talk about the inspectors, I think if you could, I don't know if that there's a question in there or it's a comment, and maybe you could comment on my comment.
Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman. One of the things we need to understand is that we can't even have those mandatory checkpoints without a conservation officer there due to the seizure. You can't have a civilian doing mandatory stops without the authority of being a peace officer in Minnesota. So you can't remove the two from each other and still facilitate this. Obviously, the conservation officer will be there for taking action on the violations. Okay, but the inspections, the conservation officer is not going to go up to the individual and start climbing around in the boat and stuff. That's up to the inspectors. The conservation officer is there to take the legal action of writing written warnings or tickets or civil citations or whatever is appropriate for the violation if one is found.
Colonel, I think it was a couple years ago, the Minnesota Supreme Court justified searches by DNR officials on boats regarding, let's say, a boat was coming off a lake and that without a probable cause they could have live wells opened, coolers, tackle boxes looking for perhaps an over limit of fish that had been taken. Question of probable cause was the question that the courts tried to resolve that day. They made a decision that was permissible under law, if I remember right, and some of us who followed that closely were rather surprised that the Supreme Court didn't recognize some of the search parameters under the Fourth Amendment. Do you think that this could get into that area where we're now pulling people over at inspection stops, looking for something? And I haven't quite heard a discussion of probable cause here. Is this a probable cause issue?
Mr. Chair, there are some similarities, obviously, but in an inspection of a boat, in most cases, we're not going into coolers and compartments and that sort of thing. We're looking for visible signs, the fact that say, zebra mussels attaching themselves to the hull of the boat. We're looking for water that has not been drained out of the bilge or out of the live wells and that sort of thing. So there are some similarities, but there's a little bit difference between the regulating the fishing regulations by checking in live wells and coolers and that sort of thing. The way that I envision these inspections are that the invasive species inspections will not be as intrusive as a conservation officer looking for over limits of fish on a boat coming off a lake at an access.
Is there any way you could assure us of that?
Mr. Chair, it's pretty hard to make promises not having gone through the process yet. We have not had the first inspection of this type yet. But our intent is to be very careful with these so as not to lose that tool. We're in the process of drafting policy for our officers when they do this, and we're in the process of going through some training manuals for the inspectors that will be involved, and it's going to be kind of a start out very, very slow and easy and work our way into it. So we're not going to jump into this thing with both feet right off the bat. To say that there won't be some hiccups or bumps, I can't promise that at this time, having never experienced the process. But we are doing our best to minimize any of those concerns, any of those issues that may arise.
I'm assuming, Colonel, that the effective date would be August 1st. It doesn't state it specifically, so it would default to August 1st of this year. So we would have a summer season to start educating people. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This provision would go into effect August 1st. However, we currently have the inspection ability for conservation officers. This particular passage here authorizes the delegation of that to local authorities and other agencies.
Okay. Any other questions? Sir Marty.
Mr. Chair, back to real quickly to the mandatory inspections. I think you're right, very much a fine line. I think if you are using these inspectors to do the, the analogy, I'm not an attorney, so I like to work in analogies on something like this. You can be forced to stop at a checkpoint in many states, not here, to pay a toll. You have to stop at a stop sign even if there's no law enforcement officer there. But if you have a checkpoint staffed by basically inspectors who are going to inspect cars, largely, as you said, for educational purposes, and the inspectors are doing they stop your car, they walk around, they check things out, and I assume if they're writing up a civil fine, it's kind of like a traffic, like a parking meter person. They're not a licensed officer. They are simply writing up a civil fine for you because you violated something. You violated the rules to protect the lakes, so they write up a civil fine. If the person somehow refuses to drain, refuses to follow the orders or something, then they call the conservation officer who can come in and take more aggressive action. Then I think you're probably not violating the stop without probable cause and checking out things, and the inspector is obviously looking at one thing. They're not looking for everything else that a conservation officer would. I think you're probably okay in that case, but I think it's important that these inspections have to be done by a non-conservation officer. Otherwise, I think you're getting into the problem of no probable cause again. I don't know. Is that tracking with what you're envisioning
here?
There'll
need to be one present.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes, we will need to have a conservation officer present at the mandatory checks. There will also be voluntary checks. We do recognize the incredible responsibility the department is asking for and how important this is to be done the right way. It needs to be done with an educational aspect first and foremost, but we need to make sure we have the tools in our toolbox to do what we need to do if a person does have water or contaminated boat there. So I can assure you that we will be looking at this and making sure it is done with the utmost care within the respect of the law and making sure that we are cautiously proceeding with this provision.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure you get the opposite point, though, too, that if the conservation officer is doing the search, they are legally, as part of their job, they are supposed to look for any violations, and they have an obligation as a licensed law enforcement officer. If you have inspections done by the inspectors who are trained and know what they're doing and educational and maybe writing up a civil fine if the person's refusing to do something or they violated something here, then you're probably okay. It's just if you have the conservation officer doing it, I think then you've got the constitutional problem. And that's what I'm saying. In other words, yes, you may have to have a conservation officer at the site or something, but if they're actually saying, well, we don't have enough inspectors, I'll do the inspections, then I think all of a sudden you're going to come up with a constitutional challenge to it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite tracking that, Senator Marty, but line 6.24 I think is fairly clear as well, that if there's not a licensed peace officer there, CO there, if a violation is an order and they're not willing to comply, then an officer would be, they would refer the violation to a conservation officer. Does that cover it, what you were talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yeah, that's, in other words, the peace officer is not stepping in until some inspector saying, hey, they're violating the law and they're refusing to comply, they're whatever, then the law enforcement, the CO steps in. But until that time, I mean, if the CO is going in there right away, then I think you've got there is no probable cause for the stop. we're just stopping you because we're going to search you and find out if there's an unreasonable search and seizure problem you've got there, I think.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I think the colonel actually covered that very well. They would be on site or fairly close to the site, so that, yes, you're right there.
Any other questions? Senator Harrington?
Mr. Chair, it still strikes me that that we are, in fact, seizing the vehicle and then taking enforcement action in this set of circumstances. And I guess I'm wondering how, for example, the truck drivers who go through the weight stations with State Patrol, how we handle that, because that's in the form of an inspection. At least my experience with State Patrol is that typically the troopers are, in fact, doing the inspection, and if you fail the inspection, there's an enforcement action taken there. So I'm wondering if this is in some way similar to that, but I'm not sure what the legal authorization that creates those weight check-in stations is and how we balance that, because this still strikes me as it's a mandatory stop, so it feels very much like a DUI checkpoint where everybody that drives through, whether or not they have any probable cause, and I get the exception for the fact that if you're not trailering a boat, you wouldn't be stopped, but it still feels like we have effectively seized their time. They cannot, from the wording of this, they cannot not go through the check station if they've got the boat, and they are subject to enforcement action without any probable cause or reasonable suspicion being there. It would be equivalent for me of saying, as a peace officer, I saw trucks driving through an area that is known for having high meth traffic or high marijuana growth in an area, and I can check every car that drives out of that forest area to check to see if they've got illegal drugs. That would be clearly unconstitutional. We would lose the drugs or anything else we seized on the base of the fruit of a poison tree doctrine that we didn't have probable cause for the stop. Therefore, anything seized thereafter would be inadmissible in court. I think this sets up the COs, if they do take enforcement action, do seize other contraband or do take other enforcement action, to lose cases based on that same doctrine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. You bounced all over from truck regulatory measures.
Yes, I did. I apologize for that.
No, that's fine. And I'm tracking you very well because I lived that life as well. And I think you know that if you're able to establish through probable cause that there is a bunch of people going in and out of the wooded area and there has been drug trafficking there, you could actually make that stop. But you'd still have to prove that basis, I believe, in court. Getting back to the trucks. That's a great analogy. It's very similar to what we're doing here. You have truck regulatory people that do that kind of work, very similar to what we're setting up here, But the trucks have no choice. I have a truck depot in Alexandria, west of Alexandria, where they are pulling over trucks because of weight restrictions and of course, of driving time, that you know, minimum requirements for drivers. They're not pulling over cars. This would be the same thing. We're not going to be pulling over cars. We're going to be pulling over boats. We're going to be pulling over possible vectors of these invasive species. So it's basically the same thing, exactly. And I don't think those regulatory officers have the right to make an arrest. I think they have to have a state trooper come and make an actual arrest. They may have the authority to do a civil violation. I'm not going to go into the weeds there because I'm not totally sure of that. But they do have just a special section of the State Patrol that does that. It's not usually your troopers running up and down. Same correlation with COs versus these types of folks.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, I guess I hope Mr. Meyer or the Colonel would, as we move the bill forward, I think Senator Harrington's example of the truck weigh stations is probably a very analogous situation, and just checking out what that is and how that's done, I think that may help give some of us a little more comfort, I think, in terms of the constitutional issues, and Senate counsel also pointed out that we have almost sort of an implied consent kind of thing for when you're using a boat on Minnesota lakes, that is there an 84D allowing the inspection of equipment to do that? Is there sort of an implied consent thing there? But I guess I'd just like assurance from DNR that they'll take a look at some of this to find out, because I think you're on a very fine line and maybe you've navigated it well, but I don't know, so...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, we will do that. We recognize the authority that we're asking for, how important it is, and we need to make sure it's done the right way. So thank you.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Hearing none. Senator Newman? Senator Ingridson, I'm sorry. Senator Ingridson moves Senate File 1839 as was there amendments? No amendments. Senator Ingridson moves Senate File 1839 be recommended to pass and move to?
I believe to the floor.
To the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Ingridson. Senator Hand.
As easy as they were on you.
Senator Hand, Senate File 1804.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And there's more members of the Health and Human Services Committee up here than there is down in our committee. So I'm just going to bring my agenda up here, and we'll just take our bills up from here, if that's all right with you.
We take one at a time, Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1804 is the Department of Human Services policy bill. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not quite sure exactly what the issues were that brought us into your committee. I think maybe I'll let you direct us to what part of the bill that we need to take some closer look at. I do know that there is at least one amendment that we need to do, which is frankly a policy fix, and I think that Senator Marty may be willing to offer that amendment.
Senator Hand, if we could wait just a moment. The summary is being handed out, as I understand it, indicates the area of our jurisdiction. And is the amendment in our packet?
A5 amendment. I don't know.
That's also coming. So if we could just wait a moment, Senator Hand. State.
Thank you. Seizing that vehicle, holding it for the it's still a seizure, and it's not a voluntary thing. Is the fact that you drove into the station, does that make it that voluntary? It's compulsory. Search and seizure issue there, but.
No, he's got it. Oh, okay.
Once you get the stop, then once you make the stop and you've had the seizures, your search clause will become.
I don't know about
it. Next question, constitutional. So, coming out of Long Island. You can already see how I lose this case.
Okay, I believe, Senator Hand, that everybody now has the amendment. It looks like it's the A6 amendment.
That's not my one.
Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment that is DL0002. Is that the same amendment that Senator Marty has? Or maybe it's been A6 is the department.
Yeah, that's the policy one. It's not A5 amendment. It's not A5, too.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I think the one that Senator Marty is prepared to offer is the A5 amendment.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe we should do that one first.
And I have in front of me an A6 amendment, so we're going to have to wait until staff can get us the correct amendment to talk about this. So we just wait a moment.
That was the first bill heard.
Senator Hand, as I understand it, the A5 amendment is staff just went out to make photocopies of it. Well, so the staff will be back here in just a moment.
Mr. Chairman, if you would
wish we could take up the A6 amendment if that is available to the committee.
If that's your desire, Senator Hand, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, and I would ask if there might be someone on the committee that might move the amendment. This is really a technical fix that was added to the language of this bill in the other body. That happened after this bill was in the HHS committee. This does not technically come into the purview of the Judiciary Committee, but there are so many members of the HHS committee here that perhaps if there are questions on the policy, we could address them here as well.
Senator Marty.
I'll move the A6 amendment.
A6 amendment has been moved. Is there any further discussion by anyone? Anyone want to testify to it? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A6 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the A5, the Senator Marty amendment, just I can briefly tell you about it. Senator Marty probably can be more in detail until it gets here. But this, again, is more of a not really a judiciary issue. It, as I understand it, has to do with a pilot program that had been implemented, and it is extending the date that that pilot is to conclude, pushing it out from a 3-year to a 5-year demonstration project, and that really is the only change. So it is more of a HHS policy amendment, technically not in the purview of the Judiciary Committee, but again, I think we're trying to get the bill as best we can to match up with where it is in the other body.
Senator Marty, we do not yet have the A5 amendment. It's my understanding you are going to be offering the A5.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and basically this was something Senator Lori had been working on. It related to some older adult community consortiums pilot project. It was 3 years. They're not asking new funding, no anything. It's just they're one of the projects that they've been working with is a little slower at getting started, and so they wanted to extend it from 3 years to 5 years. It's with existing funds. It's just it would be they asked for some extra time on it, and I believe Senator Hand has no problem with it, and the department supported this and so on.
Okay, and Senator Hand, your position on the A5?
Mr. Chairman, I'm perfectly fine with the A5 amendment, and if we're still waiting for it, if you wish, we could begin talking about some of the issues that have brought the bill to your committee, and when the amendment arrives, we can take it up at the appropriate time. It's not critical to the issues that are here for the Judiciary Committee's purview.
That would be a good idea because, you know, I don't think we should be taking the A5 up until members have seen it. So, Senator Hand, to your bill.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I am just have seen the summary that it raises the judiciary issues. As I understand it, it's within two articles, Article 1, Section 30 of the bill, and then two sections in Article 5. And I do have some assistance from the department, perhaps, that might be better suited than I am to explain what the bill does and try to address the concerns that the Judiciary Committee may have.
Mr. Senator Hand, the first individual I have on the list is Laura Sales. Am I correct?
I'm not going to be a testifier. I think Deb Siebenaller is going to testify on this particular.
Okay, very good. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Siebenaller. I work for the Department of Human Services in the Continuing Care Administration Adult Protection Unit. The section that I'm going to be testifying on today is Section 30, and it starts on page 36, line 36.32. In 1995, the Minnesota legislature established the Common Entry Point, or CEP, designation and also specified the data management process for the CEP. CEP is the county unit that's responsible for receiving oral reports of vulnerable adult maltreatment allegations, and they have to receive those reports 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's also designated by the county commissioners, so the CEPs are located within each county. The suspected maltreatment report that they receive is then sent to lead investigative agencies responsible for doing the investigation. That's the Department of Human Services Licensing Division, Department of Health, Office of Health Facility Complaints, and County Adult Protection Units. Minnesota statute said that when a centralized database is available, the common entry point has access to the database. They must log those reports into the database. In 2008, the Commissioner of Human Services developed and implemented a centralized database to capture the vulnerable adult maltreatment report information and forward them electronically to the lead investigative agencies. So this includes information that's reported to the common entry point, as well as information regarding the adult protection investigations. The database is maintained within the Social Service Information System, SSIS, and in 2011, the CEP received over 26,000 reports of vulnerable adult maltreatment. This amendment just clarifies the authority of the Commissioner of Human Services to maintain this database and receive data from the lead investigative agencies. And this is current practice. So with that, I'll pause if there's any questions about this section.
Anyone have any questions on Article 1, Section 3?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
In this particular information, common entry point data, is there a classification of how we handle this data?
Section 10. Ms. Sebanella.
Mr. Chair, I was not paying attention.
Mr. Chair, I was distracting the witness. I apologize. Is there something I need to do to get back in the good graces of the committee?
Let me start. Yeah. Senator Limmer.
Senator Latz and I will get back to you on that. I wanted to know the information that's collected in the centralized database. How is it classified?
Okay, the data is classified depending on the if it's common entry point data that is confidential data, and certain sections, pieces of that data is considered confidential, such as reporter information, cannot be disclosed unless under authority of the court. And then if it's active data, active investigative data, it's confidential data, and it becomes private data after the investigation is concluded, and it's all categories under the welfare data.
Mr. Chair. Are you using HIPAA federal law in that definition, or using state law?
We use both. Our Minnesota statute refers to state law, state data privacy and practices.
We have new members on the committee, and I want to make sure that people realize that in Minnesota, or any state, is given the right to make stronger data privacy protection than the federal government. And we have taken our license on that to do that. And I just wanted to make sure that we confirm that we're following the state provisions, not just HIPAA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we are.
Senator Hahn, your next testifier then. Is that all on Article 1, Section 30?
Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, that is the only provision in Article 1 that...
Any other questions then of committee members regarding Article 1, Section 30? Please proceed, Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Article 5 are two sections that are in the purview of the Judiciary Committee, and we'll seek more expert testimony from another witness.
Thank you. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Jennifer Blanchard, and I am with the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. The first provision is on page 9, line 20, and it's with regard to the IEP consent on an MA application. This provision removes a reference in Minnesota Statute 125A21 Subdivision 7 to parental consent given as part of a Minnesota care health care application. Last legislative session, MDE proposed this language, and throughout the session with discussion, it was determined that this language was not necessary. It was removed in two places in law. However, at the end of the session, one piece was not taken out. So that is specifically more of a technical change, but would take any questions on that if you had them.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, now it's my turn. Could you repeat what you just said regarding the student information?
Absolutely.
And in doing so, could you give us the page number? I'm having a hard time finding it.
Page 95.
Thank you.
Line 20. And this is specific to language that was introduced last legislative session by the Department of Education, and it was language that was determined unnecessary. It was pulled from two of the three places they had proposed putting it into law. One of the pieces did not get pulled, and so it is nothing that had been implemented. It is not a current policy, and it just needs to be removed from current statute.
Senator Lim.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. You explained that it's information that, or this doesn't need to be necessary, but could you give us a background? What is the information? I see that we're talking of a school district may disclose information contained in the student's education program, including records of the student's diagnosis and treatment to a health plan company. So is this authorizing the school district to give information to that plan?
Ms. Blanchard.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I don't have that detail with me. What I can say is the intent was to put a release of information on our medical applications, which then in turn later would allow for that. It was determined that that is information that cannot go on our medical applications, and that is why they determined to pull it from statute.
Mr. Chair, I see that you're striking consent that the parent or legal representative gave. So is the purpose of this section to transfer information from the school district to another without parental consent?
Ms. Blanchard.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Education and what their original intent was. That is information I certainly can get back to you.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out in the language that's existing in law in that subdivision 7, it talks about that the school district may disclose some information about to a health plan, if you look on line 95.24, only with the signed and dated consent of the student's parent or other legally authorized individual. So that consent provision to release information has been in law, is in law. This part that is stricken is not interfering with the requirement that there be consent given to release information.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
In this type of release, is this on the, let's say, the first year that a student enrolls in a school district, let's say first grade, and would that release be legal all the way through 12th grade without ever revisiting the issue ever again?
Mr. Chair, Senators, again, it is Minnesota Department of Education statute, and so that isn't something that I can speak to.
All right.
Any further discussion regarding Article 5, Section 1? Senator Hand, have we talked about Section 20 yet?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that has been covered, so we probably need to have a little bit of explanation from Ms. Blanchard and then any questions from the committee.
Ms. Blanchard.
Mr. Chair, Senators, this article can be found on page 120, line 9. And this proposal would require only the last four digits of a medical assistant recipient's Social Security number to be included on an MA lien notice or a notice of potential claim. Current state law requires an MA lien notice and a notice of potential claim to contain a Social Security number of an MA recipient. Title companies, attorneys, and family members often do not have access to a recipient's MAXIS case number when they're calling to obtain information about a lien. And this provides, using the Social Security number, which is already in current law, provides a way for these cases to be identified. The purpose of this legislation is aligned with other efforts designed to protect against identity theft when a Social Security number is used. And the last four digits of the Social Security number is an easy way to narrow down particular recipient involved in a lien or a notice of potential claim.
Just kind of an open question. I've often seen this issue of last four digits of a Social Security number being used in a wide variety of matters. And I'm just kind of curious, why do we select the last four digits of a Social Security number as opposed to the others? Anyone have any? Does anybody know? I'm just curious.
What is your number?
I can't remember.
I'll have a check. I'll have it checked out.
I can see nobody else knows the answer to that question either. Anything further on the bill itself other than the A5 amendment, Senator Hamm?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Just a word of caution. I'm okay with this provision, but I want to, members to know that there are now companies that are requiring the first five digits of your Social Security number. And it doesn't take much of an information harvester type company to get that information. And they can start merging it, and everyone's Social Security number will be known to whoever you give that information to. So this is something that we should really keep a very careful eye on, and maybe with the idea of maybe not relying on any digits on a Social Security number. I know the whole world will fall apart if we do that, but at least everyone else will be a little more secure.
And I will tell you, I agree with Senator Limmer's thoughts. In point of fact, in a bill that I recently had in Health and Human Services, I removed or had deleted the inclusion of a Social Security number from a Health and Human Services bill. Now, I know that there are requirements throughout our statutes for Social Security numbers, but I really think we ought to be aware of and really cautious about requiring by statute the disclosure of that number. Any further discussion amongst the members regarding Article 5, Section 20? Seeing none, let's go back then to the A5 amendment. I believe, members, you now have it in front of you. Is there any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Senator Engelbretson.
Yeah, just, you know, and I think I may have stepped out of the room or missed it, Senator Marty. Why 3 to 5?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this came from Senator Gorey, but there's the department has been doing this demonstration project on these combining older adult community services, and they, a couple of the projects they're working on are in the middle of the project, and they'd like to extend it. No more money, no more anything else. And they just are in the middle of it. They'd like it to continue with the existing money they started with.
Any further discussion on the A5 amendment?
Senator Hamm.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, I think it just has to do with trying to get Social Security numbers attached to invasive species.
It's something like that.
And, it's a demonstration project, and we'll so not to worry. So, okay.
Mr. Chair.
The amount of Senator Engelbrecht.
The amount of paranoia in this group, I'm just wondering who I'm sitting with today.
Senator
Engelbrecht, can we request backgrounds for this committee? I'm sorry.
We're going to move this bill to environment.
To where?
Environment. Okay, that's
there it will be dealt with accordingly.
We are losing control. I don't believe at this point.
Letting a little line out, Art.
Sorry,
no
Mr.
humor in judiciary. At this point, I don't believe we have yet moved the A5 amendment.
I'll move the
A5. Senator Hahn, do you have a position on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I support the amendment. It is consistent with the policy we have, and there's no cost to it. So.
Senator Marty.
I move the A5 amendment.
Any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
Move the bill.
Any further discussion on Senate File 1804? Seeing none, do I hear a motion? Senator Marty.
I'll move the bill. Does it go to finance?
No.
No. To the floor? I'll move that Senate File 1804 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the bill is on its way to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I apologize for being so disruptive to your committee.
Hey, he looks broken up.
You want to look out. You might get pulled over in the hallway going down.
We're going to go to Senate File 2184.
I got to go.
You go.
Oh, really? They can sit, can't they, Mr. Chair? Oh, there you go.
I think so. This is Bermuda. I brought
up. Teach him to keep us here on Friday.
We're doing that on Fridays now. The child is important to Bermuda.
Yeah, I was really interested in that one.
Where trucks do have to stop. You get inspected.
Oh, yeah, that could. I wonder.
You give him a civil fine. So there's a slight against the child.
Yes, sir.
My concern was this to just to check.
We just don't know
whatever basis for the things you're looking for. But.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the time today. Senate File 2184 involves title work, the transferring of titles, but in a very narrow way. It involves title work on timeshares. In light of some of the market conditions that have been experienced in northern Minnesota, many of these timeshare values have dropped considerably. In comparison to the price of the property itself, the timeshare, that let's say 1 or 2 week time slot that an owner buys, when one changes the title, changes that real estate title for that period of time, the title cost is getting rather excessive. And there's a number of foreclosures now that are devaluing the property, even so much that the title work is beginning to exceed the value of the property itself. And so here we have Carrie Rood, who represents the Breezy Point area and represents this particular issue, and Mr. Jerry Steinke, an attorney that can better explain the difficulty of what's going on in these transactions.
Who would like to testify first? Ms. Rood, please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Carrie Rood, and I come to you today as a business owner and a property owner and a former mayor of Breezy Point. Many of you have had the opportunity to come visit our beautiful city, whether it's for a wedding or for a vacation or a convention. And you can understand how important our tourism is to us and also our timeshares. We have approximately 12,000 timeshare owners in Breezy Point. And these folks come from all over the state and all over the United States to come visit us. And they're very important to our economy. They use our shops, they use our gas stations, they use our restaurants. And so we rely heavily on these folks coming to visit us. The resorts also use the timeshare units as rental units for state conventions. You see that we do a lot of convention business in Breezy Point. Also, beautiful weddings. So we use them in a variety of ways. You will see in your packet I've given you, there is a sheet that shows you the current foreclosures that are in process in Breezy Point at this time. This is just for the Narvis and Management Group. There are other groups, and so this is not a complete list. They are all in process, and they are all very costly. While we understand that the foreclosure process is very necessary to get to go through so that everyone is taken care of, the timeshares in Breezy Point have an additional burden because they are torrents title instead of abstract. So while they go through the whole process in as an abstract property does, then they're also required to do an extra step. So getting the property back on the market and to back into the associations can cost upward of $4,500. I've also put in your packet a list of the timeshare resales that are currently on the market, and you can see the prices of them anywhere from $200 on up. These are asking prices, but they don't necessarily even get these prices. So we are getting to a crisis point in Breezy Point, and in order for Breezy Point to be a healthy community, we need our timeshare associations to be healthy also. So what we are doing, we have worked very hard on the language on this bill. We have worked with Mr. Steinke, who works for Breezy Point International. We have also sought from the Minnesota Bar Association, the real property section. We had them review this and give us some technical feedback on this bill. So we think we have a pretty narrow scope to handle these. It is also a county opt-in, so none of the counties will be affected unless they decide to opt in. Crow Wing County is very anxious to help the city of Breezy Point in this, and so they obviously will be anxious to opt in, but no other county needs to do this. I will tell you that Breezy Point is the only Torrance title timeshare in the state of Minnesota. So with that, we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rood. Is it Mr. Sankey?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jerry B. Steinke.
Steinke.
Attorney at law, Brainerd, Minnesota. And as Ms. Rood indicated, I represent, in my case, three of the 14 timeshare associations that have the common interest communities at Breezy Point Resort Complex.
Please, do you have testimony that you wish to present?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, as Carrie Rood indicated, because of the economic stress the timeshare associations are under, we're requesting a change in legislation affecting Torrance timeshare units. Under current law, if a timeshare association is experiencing an owner who is defaulting on paying their annual membership fees, the association's only remedy is to foreclose that owner's interest in the timeshare unit. Under Minnesota law, we have two methods of foreclosing. The method that's used in most cases for these timeshare associations is called foreclosure by advertisement. And that's a non-judicial remedy, and that is used in Minnesota probably in the vast majority of any type of foreclosure. And under this chapter of Minnesota law, Chapter 580, foreclosure by advertisement, owners do get a significant amount of due process protection. So that would continue under the proposed legislation. As Ms. Root indicated, the cost of the foreclosure process is significant. In my case, my experiences have been it costs approximately $2,500 and takes up to 10 months to be completed, including the redemption period. Because these timeshare associations are Torrance property, the associations have to go through a second procedural process. They have to complete a specialized lawsuit called a proceeding subsequent in district court. And under that lawsuit, the timeshare association asked the district court judge to review the foreclosure to make sure it was legally sufficient. It meets Minnesota law. And at the end of the process, if the judge finds that the process was completed, was properly conducted, then the district court will issue an order directing the registrar of titles to issue a new certificate to the timeshare association, so the association will now own the property so they can put it in the market, get it sold to a new owner so that they can start getting the annual maintenance fees coming in so they can continue to be economically viable. Because of the cost of the proceeding subsequent is an additional, in my experience, about $2,200 and takes an additional 4 to 6 months. So because these are Torrance timeshare units, the timeshare associations have to go through the second process, this lawsuit called a proceeding subsequent. This legislation modifies that requirement slightly. For these low-value timeshares, what we are requesting in this legislation is that rather than having a district court determine that the foreclosure was completed properly, that it was legally sufficient, the alternate process here will be to have the county examiner of titles. Each county that has Torrance property has an examiner of titles who is an experienced attorney who has a lot of experience and an expertise in the area of foreclosure. The examiner titles will look at the foreclosure process rather than the district court judge. And if the examiner titles finds that the process was completed properly, The examiner will issue a report directing the registrar to issue a new certificate of title. So rather, under the proposed legislation, rather than having a lawsuit, having the district court involved, we're requesting, as an alternative, have the examiner of titles do this in lieu of the district court. The due process protections of the owners continue. They still have the same protections under Chapter 580. So we're requesting the committee's consideration of this change to the Torrens chapter of Minnesota statutes. Thank you very much.
Any questions by any of the members? I see Senator McGuire with a very perplexed look on her face.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steinke, just to make sure that I understand you correctly, you said the due process is the same. It's just you're in front of a different hearing. You're in front of an administrative law judge or instead of a court judge. Or what's different about the process then if the due process is the same? So they still can file a claim. Is it just who it's in front of?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, the due process protections of the foreclosure by advertisement process, Chapter 580, remains the same under our proposed change. The only difference is rather than having a district court judge look at the foreclosure record to see if it was done adequately, we are asking rather in this case for these low-value timeshares that the examiner of titles, who is a trained attorney, who is a third party, a neutral, will look at the same process to see if it was conducted properly. And if he or she finds that the foreclosure was done correctly under Minnesota law, then the examiner of titles will then issue a report directing the registrar to issue a new certificate. Throughout this entire process, owners always have the opportunity, if they find that they have a claim, they can always bring suit in district court. Oh, okay. That's always available. So their due process, there are still due process protections in place. It just expedites the process for the second step. Rather than doing a proceeding subsequent, we have an examiner's report.
Members, I would indicate to you that over the years I had dealt with examiners of titles on many, many issues, many, many times, and the examiners of titles in the various counties are indeed experienced real estate lawyers, and what is being requested here is that, Mr. Steinke had pointed out, an independent person, i.e. the examiner of titles, is going to look at this and render an opinion as to whether or not the proper procedures have been followed in the foreclosure proceedings, and that's where the due process comes in. And due process in terms of foreclosure is strictly by statute. I mean, you just literally go down the numbers. And if everything is in place, then the examiner of titles is going to issue a report directing the registrar of titles that everything is fine in terms of due process. So I really don't see any problem in terms of due process. It appears to me to be an appropriate piece of legislation, and I'd be willing to bet that the court system is going to be happy with not having to deal with this also. So I think it's probably a pretty good idea. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for clarifying that even more. That's helpful. I'm just unclear. Does every county have an examiner of title? Do they have more than one, and are they the county employees, or just I just don't know very much about examiner of titles. So while we're on the subject, if you could just educate me a little bit. I don't have any trouble with it. I'm curious.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, in Minnesota, just generally speaking, there are four counties that have a significant amount of Torrens lands, and that would be Ramsey County, Hennepin County, St. Louis County, and Crow Wing County. So the other counties in Minnesota have very little Torrens, but in any county that has Torrens lands, the county will have an examiner of titles, an experienced attorney who will be appointed by the county commissioners and approved by the district court judge, and it's typically a highly experienced attorney who has a lot of background in real estate law. In the case of the larger counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis County, the examiner titles is an employee of the county. But in the case of the smaller counties like Crow Wing County where we're at, that person's a private attorney who just is appointed to this additional duty, and then he or she charges a fee for conducting his or her work for an individual client rather than being a county employee. But any county that has registered Torrance property will have an examiner of titles appointed and serving in that capacity.
Thank you.
So, Senator McGuire, for instance, in the county that I come from, we do have some Torrance property, but not a lot. And we have precisely the system that has just been described, a private attorney who has been appointed by the board, given the blessing of the district court judges. And in my case, the examiner of titles is indeed a very experienced real estate lawyer. So I think that the description that has just been given to you is very, very accurate. We do have an A-12 amendment that appears to me to be a technical amendment. Members, if you go to page 2 of the bill, line 2.16, looks like we're going to swap out the name county recorder that doesn't exist anymore and insert registrar of titles. Senator Limmer, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. The amendment is technical in nature. The A-12 amendment would be considered an author's amendment.
Any further discussion
on the A-12 amendment?
And any further discussion on the A-12 amendment? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
Chair, I wanted to make sure that Mr. John Winker has submitted a letter, a law firm from Quinn Levin and Hughes, PA, in support of the bill, just so there's a record of that.
Very good, Senator Limmer. Senator Marty.
Can I just ask, Mr. Chair, if there's anyone in the audience who's concerned about this or objections to this?
Anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to either in favor or against the bill? Seeing none, any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate file number 2184 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is adopted.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next, we are going to hear Senator Gerlach's bill 1572. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1572 is before you. I will have an amendment, but this is its second stop, so I'll ask for consideration of that. But right now, I'd just like to explain and put before you the concept and the policy so you have an understanding and a context, and then we can talk about some of the specifics and why it's before this committee here. So let me just start, members, by saying that this issue has been was brought to me last year for the first time by the executive director of the co-roundtable, Mr. Steve Young, and he unfortunately was not able to be here to testify today. He's out of the country, but he gave a very eloquent presentation on his experience in working with this issue for a number of years. What I will do my best is to try to replicate as much of that passion and knowledge and background that he had in the issue. So, members, here's what it is. This is a bill before you is conceptually creating a new corporate entity. You're familiar with the notion of a corporation, a for-profit corporation owned by shareholders, with its purpose is to provide products and services to make money for its shareholders. And on the other hand, you have another sector of the economy, another form of organization is nonprofits, which Nonprofits are formed to provide some social good, some social purpose, but they lack working capital. They don't have investors. They, of course, receive donations, and that's how they operate. And both of those organizations have certainly served us well. However, there are some shortcomings on both ends of those that this bill tends to solve by creating a hybrid and in between a public benefit corporation. On the corporate side of the coin, you have one of the deficiencies is that if you're legally obligated to seek profit your prime motivator, which is a good thing, which has built the economy of this country, and that's a wonderful thing. However, if you want to do some social good or something along what you might want, you might want to do, if it sacrifices some profits, you then are exposed to liability and potential shareholder lawsuits because you're not pursuing profit as your primary purpose. And therefore, this will allow for the ability for a company to establish itself and say that we are taking investors and we do have a business plan. We will earn profits, but instead of being obligated to an 18% return or whatever it might be to our shareholders, we will live with a 6% or an 8% return. Investors know that up front. And with that gap, we will then do some social good as we will organize to do. And that could be anything from energy sector items or maybe housing. It could be in educational areas. It could be a whole range of things, anything that you can imagine in the public could be done. And then if we take the other side of the coin with the nonprofits, and we have they live hand to mouth, they get donations, but they aren't able to build up working capital, and this hamstrings a lot of nonprofits that would and could do more. So this will allow them to have some of those aspects, and when you meld them together, you get a new corporate entity that we are calling a public benefit corporation. That is the concept of what we're trying to do. We're taking the best from both of those and putting that together. Members, that is the explanation. I have Mr. Burt Black from the Secretary of State's office to offer some insight in corporate organizations. He's been working in this area for many decades, and if you could, he would like to say a few words. So, Mr. Black.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, and members of the committee. My name is Burt Black. I am the legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. I've been with the office since 1981, and I want to take members of the committee back to 1987. Senator Marty was, I don't recall if you were a member of the committee, but you were a member of the body. I think Senator Limmer and Senator McGuire were not yet elected to the House, and Senator Goodwin, you might have been a legislative employee, so you might remember this. During the first special session in 1987, that was the special session that was called. Oh, and of course, Kathy Pontius was involved in this as well. During the first special session, that session was called to make sure that the language was passed that would make it more difficult to take over a Minnesota corporation, specifically the Dayton Hudson Corporation, now the Target Corporation. And language was passed that really embodies the core concepts of what we're talking about in this bill. That language said, and it's still in the law, 302A.251, subdivision, subdivision 5. And that says, in discharging the duties of the position of director, a director may, in considering the best interests of the corporation, consider the interests of the corporation's employees, customers, suppliers, and creditors, the economy of the state and nation, community and societal considerations, and the long-term as well as short-term interests of the corporation and its shareholders, including the possibility that these interests may be best served by the continued independence of the corporation. So you can see that that is clearly targeted towards the takeover issues that were present at the time. So we have this core concept in state law already coming up on 25 years. So you might ask, well, why do we have the bill before us? Isn't this enough? And in addition to the explanation that Senator Gerlach gave with respect to sort of the business and economic model, I just want to point out that there are some legal reasons to have this as a separate kind of corporation. The what's called the received model or the normal model of business corporation law is, as Senator Gerlach mentioned, that the residual value of the organization is to the shareholders, and that the fiduciary duty of the board of directors and the officers is to the corporation, that is, to the shareholders. Now, I will say I am not the world's expert on fiduciary duty. I'm not a private practitioner, but I talk with private practitioners quite a bit and keep in touch with them. And this residual value model creates certain expectations that the entire effort of a business corporation is going to be for the benefit, to produce profits for the benefits of the shareholders. Now, whether you take a long-term or short-term view of how to get there, that's the goal. That received model creates a certain amount of reservations by both businesses and attorneys to exercise the language that we have in 302A.251, which I read to you. Having this as a separate kind of corporation, it does a number of things. Number one, it's a reiteration by the state of this policy. It says, we mean this. We really mean this. Also, in the bill, you'll notice that in Section 5, the language is that the directors or officers shall discharge the duties in a manner the director reasonably believes to be in the best interests of the corporation as defined in Section 2, the definitional section. The existing language is discretionary. Okay, so that's if you are going to be this public benefit corporation, you are going to exercise this judgment for a broader group. Because people are going to form these corporations and invest them as a fresh start, it's going to relieve the expectation, any expectation from the past, that this particular business is all about the shareholders. It's not. It has a broader mission. It has a broader mission in one sense in terms of serving a broader set of community. But in another sense, it has, because of the definition of public benefit, it has a more focused mission of providing public goods and improvements and advantages for the general public well-being. That is to say, if somebody's going to be involved in this kind of corporation, they're going to know exactly what they're getting into, and they should have no expectation that they are the only that a shareholder is the only beneficiary of the monetary profits of the public benefit corporation. Lastly, I want to point out that the bill provides for additional stakeholder engagement and public interest reports. And these are ways of making sure that the broader stakeholder community is involved with the corporation. This is mandatory. It's not discretionary. Some Minnesota has a good reputation for corporate citizenship. I'm sure some of our corporations already do a version of this. But this would say if you're going to bear the imprint of a public benefit corporation, if you're going to identify yourself as that, you will do stakeholder engagement, and you will provide public interest reports. And I think there's We'll talk about that at the amendment. So, in conclusion, this is a reinforcement of Minnesota policy that's already been on the books, for almost 25 years, and frankly will free up our legal community and business community to actually exercise that option, which they have not felt free to do up till now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Is this a good idea for investors in a corporation?
Depends on the investor, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good idea for investors who are interested in both providing these goods and earning a reasonable return. I guess I would say I'm not a financial advisor, but I would guess that these companies won't have the highest return on investment. So I guess it depends on the investor and what they're looking for.
Mr. Black, are you satisfied with the standard of accountability to an investor?
I guess I can't really speak to that at this point. While I have been following this for a while, I don't follow it necessarily with the completely with the investor's point of view.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to also add,
Senator,
one reason this works, one of the motivating factors, I think, for investors conceptually would be that you at least, you may not get, you won't get as large of a return, but you will maintain your principal investments. Whereas, say, in a nonprofit, you write the check, it is now theirs. But you can at least, you can remain engaged in what this company is doing, and I think you'd probably be much more of an engaged shareholder than you might be if you were just a straight, investor in a regular for-profit. But you get to maintain your principal investment, assuming the company's profitable.
Sir Gerlach, does this mean that you would add new articles of incorporation to an existing corporation?
Mr. Chair?
Well,
maybe Senator Marty can make a comment.
Marty on
that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, though, in effect, this would be an option. If you want to start a corporation in Minnesota, you could incorporate under 302A, or under this case, you could incorporate under this 304A, which is basically relying on everything else except for these provisions. And in effect, if you say, hey, I want to make some money doing this, I got this great invention, but I think it also could be good for community, or I really prioritize paying my employees more, or whatever other public interests. In other words, not just maximizing you as an individual shareholder's profit or whatever else, but saying these other stakeholders, whether that's the employees, the customers, the community, the environment, whatever, if you have interest in those things as well, then you would choose perhaps to say, I'm going to incorporate under 304A. And the biggest thing it would do for you is it would then, among other shareholders, whether you got 20 friends investing with you or whether you go public at some point, they could not sue you for the fact that you are doing something for some other stakeholder, the community. Hey, maybe you want to, in a small town, you want to keep business local, so you're going to buy from local suppliers, even if that's costing you a little bit more. Your shareholders will get a lower rate of return, but you cannot be sued by your shareholders for being concerned about other stakeholders here. So in effect, you would choose to incorporate under this or the other one. Your investors would know we chose to do this in this benefit corporation. We chose to invest in that because we care about the community and making a profit or whatever.
Yep. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, everything that you have just described seems to me could be accomplished in a normal business corporation by and through the articles of incorporation and the bylaws. So I'm a little bit lost as to the need for this new form of a corporation.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I think the reason, and I do remember that provision 1987, where, in effect, the corporation that was being subject to a hostile takeover, at that time, they were giving 5% of their pre-tax profits to the community. they were donating 5% of their pre-tax profits. And some of the shareholders, as was becoming obvious in the hostile takeover move, were saying, hey, listen, we can get, we'll do a better job for shareholders this way. And then you're at the risk where the corporate board could be sued by shareholders saying, you haven't maximized our profits. Even though I don't know what their corporate charter, their articles of incorporation said in them, but it's always been in that corporation a plan that they were going to give 5% pre-tax profits away. This is something totally voluntary. It doesn't give the corporation any tax advantages or anything else. But if the people incorporating choose to go this route, then they do have a little bit of liability protection. If they are, they still have the same obligation, the fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders, but they can also factor in other things, and the shareholders have to realize that we chose to go into this, we chose to invest in this corporation, even though their articles of incorporation say we're concerned about the local community, so we may not make as much rate of return on it because of that.
Sir Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a really good piece of legislation. I think I'm kind of reaching back to corporations class in law school because I don't practice in this area. my memory is that the fiduciary duty of the board was to maximize shareholder profit. And then you have to make sometimes a more convoluted argument to say, well, giving 5% of our pre-tax profits to the community in the long run will maximize our profit because more people will think good things about Dayton's and come into our stores and buy more goods, so we can maximize the amount in the end we can distribute to shareholders, or we'll increase the price of the shares. That's a more convoluted, extended argument to make, and it's certainly more vulnerable to legal challenge in a court to make a decision on that. Putting a Chapter 304A in that explicitly authorizes the corporation to consider those other priorities as part of their fiduciary obligation, shields them, would shield them from that kind of a lawsuit or that kind of an attack, much more than current law would, I suspect. I'm practicing law in a field I don't understand that well here, but at least my sense and memory of it is that that this would be quite a benefit. And that there would be some corporations that would want to take advantage of this or would form explicitly for the purpose of advancing the public good in ways other than simply profit distribution, while also focusing on the ability to take profits for the founders and investors. I think that's a good hybrid to create.
So we'll be having a lot of Paul Newman products being sold off the back door of another corporation.
Good food, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I did have a question, though, too, if I may.
Yeah, please.
I was reading Subdivision 3 here, and I don't know how much work you've done, if that was a very finely tuned description of public benefit, but I'm having a little bit of trouble following it. Just from a grammatical standpoint, I wonder if there's some way to make it.
What line are you making?
Line 1.13 on the bill. And maybe it's just I haven't had a cup of coffee yet this morning, but I wonder if there's some way to make it a little clearer. Maybe counsel can take a look at it and see if there's a way to. I can imagine putting a comma here and deleting it.
Yeah, that's probably error.
Do you have anything specific, Senator Lapp?
Yeah, there are three.
Well, I was sitting here reading it, trying to figure out how to make it a little more clear, and haven't come up with a good way to do it yet. If I were going to take a shot at it, probably on line 1.14, I'd put a comma after goods. I would delete the and following it. And then on maybe that's all it would need. 1.15, sort of the general public well-being of all these communities, is a little bit of an awkward phrase, I think, but I guess it hangs together if you realize it all goes together.
That's Chair Latz, as I look at the line on 1-4, the word undertakings public goods, it kind of messes me up too. And I don't know if undertakings is considered a verb or a noun in this case.
Mr. Chairman, as I read it, it was a noun through for-profit business undertakings. And then...
But there's some transition between undertakings providing, that's necessary.
At 1.13, I think the providing is the verb there that applies to public goods. And then the directly through for-profit business undertakings is the mechanism by which the provision of public goods, et cetera, will be accomplished. Same words.
That's what they really need.
Challenge, yeah. Grammatical.
Mr. Chairman, members, I was saying, Ab, how about on page 1, line 13, put a comma after providing? And then on line 14, put a comma after undertakings.
Yeah.
It's still awkward, but yeah. I think that was.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Marty.
Yes, Senator Latz, this has changed many times, and I agree. It's very far from artfully well written here. But maybe if you took the, I think, Senate counsel's two commas would help. But what if you change it to public benefit means providing public goods and improvements and advantages, or however we want to change that, for the general public well-being, et cetera, through for-profit business undertakings. In other words, restructure the order of the sentence. Providing public goods and improvements, or whatever, public goods and advantages for the general public well-being through for-profit business undertakings. And I don't even think you need directly or indirectly in there, but...
Mr. Chairman, I'm about the idea, and the only thing that's going through my head is the grammar rock song, a noun is a person, place, or thing, and I beyond that, I don't read the grammar. Whatever the wording is, I mean, if Senator Marty's proposal works and it meets Senator Latz's needs and Senate Council is able to make it work, that makes no difference to me. And the idea is preserved.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
perhaps Senate Council could try and take a stab at that, or Senator Latz, but we also have the A1 amendment. Do you wanted that offered now, Senator Gerlach?
Yes, we could do that, and yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd offer that, but I think two things. One, I think on line 3 of the A1 amendment, we don't need the word, the S at the end of incorporation. And I think, Senator Gerlach, you wanted to delete the last sentence as well.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and to the A1 amendment, this language was used from something previous, and a part of it got carried over, which does not apply, and that would be the final sentence of the amendment where it reads, a report that meets the requirements of such and such. So it would be strike the last sentence, I guess line 1.23, after the period, strike everything, and then strike line 1.24.
And, Senator Marty, what was your reference?
In the line 1.3, it should be articles of incorporation, singular, not plural.
Oh, all right.
So I'll incorporate that in and offer the amendment.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Any further discussion? Senator Marty moves the oral amendment, striking S after the word incorporation on line 3 and striking the last sentence starting at line 1.23. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The A1 amendment now is before us.
Mr. Chairman, I could speak to the amendment.
Please.
In crafting the bill, we reached out and got some technical advice from the Minnesota Bar Association on where there might be some weaknesses, and we received some ideas about what we could probably do with this on Tuesday, and so then I implored Kathy Bonius to, even though as overworked as she is, if she could help come up with something, and through her valiant efforts, that's what you're seeing is the A1 amendment, and there's essentially three components. The first one expands a little or adds more clarity to what the community of interest stakeholder is. That would be on line 120 of the bill, page 1, line 20.
and just simply adds, as identified by the Articles of Incorporation, so the community of interest will be defined by themselves. So that will be clear and won't be fluid and changing. The other item was there's some question about what do we, you know, what is the existing corporate law? How does that apply here? And what we did is rather than simply restating whole bodies of statute and replicating them then here, we're just simply saying everything that is in current corporate law applies with the exceptions. So anything provided in those chapters 304A.04 and 05 apply. And then the third and final one was on the accountability side, and that is something that we had some discussion in our committee as well, and the amendment offers expanded language to make clear about the stakeholder impact and also the accountability feature of the public interest reports. So that is the purpose of the amendment.
Mr. Gerlach, or Senator Gerlach, I have two questions. On line 10 of the amendment, makes reference that the public benefit corporation shall provide constructive opportunities for engagement. Do we have any definition of what constructive opportunities is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Further down the next line, it does say such as, and it provides, it doesn't have a, I mean, it doesn't like define, it doesn't say constructive opportunities is defined as, but it does say such as regular stakeholder meetings scheduled by the board or a website or email listserv provided by the corporation for communications among those stakeholders and between those stakeholders and the officers and directors. So we do follow up that with where we say such as.
Sir Marty.
Mr. Chair, you could probably strike the word constructive there because I don't think anybody would be thinking of destructive opportunities for engagement. I think you could. I'll move to strike the word constructive because I think it says the same
thing. Senator Marty moves to strike an oral amendment on line 10 of the A1 amendment, the word constructive, to delete that word. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Latz.
On line 16, do we wish to keep constructively?
Constructively. No.
Senator Marty?
I suggest we should have deleted that one as well. Mr. Chair, I'll move that.
So Senator Marty moves to strike the word on line 16 of the A1 amendment, the word constructively, public benefit, and engaging. Any further discussion? Hearing any, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach, if I can make reference to line 19 and 20, you make reference to some kind of federal security law. Is there a specific site that you could give us, or at least a date that we should follow? Security, federal security law can change over time, and if someone looks at this 10 years from now, is it going to be the same federal security law that you're referring to today?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer to Senate counsel on that, on the impact of the securities laws. I'll let her speak first if she has a thought.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I might actually defer to Mr. Black. I don't know if you can add anything to it.
Mr. Chairman, it just references the date of the annual financial report as required to be filed.
It's not a site reference. Okay. No. All right. All right. The A1 amendment is before us. Any further amendments? Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment? signify by saying aye.
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 And those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Got a block, yeah. Sir Latz.
I'm going to take a stab at the public benefit definition on lines 1.13 to 1.15, proposed to amend it as follows. I guess I'll describe the amendment in the proper language, and I'll read the whole thing through. On line 1.13, after providing, insert a comma, strike directly or indirectly. On line 1.14, after undertakings, insert a comma, after, strike through for-profit business undertakings. Not insert a comma there. After goods, insert a comma, and strike and. On line 1.15, after the, insert well-being of the. After the word public, strike well-being, strike of. Its place, insert in. After the word communities, insert through for-profit business undertakings. Mm-hmm. So it would read, Mr. Chairman, public benefit means providing public goods, comma, improvements and advantages for the well-being of the general public in local, state, national, or world communities, comma, through for-profit business undertakings.
Everyone understand the amendment? Senator Latz renews his oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Gerlach, now that the focus came on, we usually don't make reference to world communities in state statute. What is a world community? Is that like the United Nations, or is it a nonprofit organization that may be a global outreach of some sort?
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, I guess I didn't. I'm not wedded to the language here, but I'm just thinking. You know, I'm always thinking of examples of how this could be applied potentially. I have a friend who was pursuing a business opportunity at one time for the construction of small solar-powered ovens. And it had two markets. One was for the camper, if you're going to go into Yellowstone, and the other was for third world underdeveloped nations where they don't have electricity wired up, and that there is a big market for relief organizations to purchase these and distribute them in third world nations around the world. And so this could be something. I mean, he had how do you get investors in something like that? And this would be a model that potentially he could use, because you could see the marketing power of something like that and being able to provide these low power to around the world. So maybe that might be an application to answer your question about where that might apply. But I'm certainly not wedded to the language if the chairman of the committee would want to strike that, but potentially one example.
Well, Senator Gerlach, the question I have is, you're describing a product that could be used around the world by, let's say, a relief association. But the relief association may not have a maybe it's a nonprofit that's got it's set up as a nonprofit in England and America, but is that a world community? I just think that the language lacks definition. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that the primary thing is what Senator Latz's wording is, the well-being of the general public.
Straight.
Basically in anywhere.
Anywhere. Yeah.
I think distinguishing, saying, hey, the general public, you might be focusing just on a small local community, you might be focusing broader than that, but whether this is the right language or not, I don't know. But I think that's his point. And, I mean, in the example that Senator Gerlach gave, again, if this public benefit corporation is dealing with a nonprofit like that, they may be selling them below what they would otherwise sell them, and their shareholders would be aware that they're trying to do something for the goal.
Would there be any damage to the essence of this provision if we simply put a period after the word public?
You need that through for-profit.
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak to that. Certainly, I mean, again, I'm not wedded to that, but you could, I wouldn't say put a period after public. I would say, because you need the through for-profit business undertakings.
Oh.
That last trailer part there.
That's right.
So you're essentially proposing just to strike in local, state, national, and world communities.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I wouldn't want anyone to consider the term general public to be somehow limiting state law.
Right.
Whether someone could argue that general public, the public really only we're applying to here is state of Minnesota public. I kind of like having the broader statement. Maybe the term international is more comfortable than world. Perhaps in some ways more common usage, international communities. If you got a company here that's only focus is to benefit Haiti, that would be encompassed as well.
Good point, Senator Latz. I'm thinking of an organization like Feed Our Starving Children, and they're based out of Brooklyn Park, but they go worldwide, and their products go worldwide, and they have some organization in every country that or a subsidiary of some sort that disperses their food packets everywhere. And so I could see where that would work. I'm just hung up on the
international
world communities. It just doesn't seem to have a definition
like
to it.
Like
Senator Latz moves that the word world on line 15 be deleted and the word international replacing that word. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, I should have asked you, Senator Gerlach. I'm sorry.
Chime in, Mr. Chairman, if I need to.
All right. Any other questions on the bill? Here, Senator Newman.
Is there anyone in the community, or I'm sorry, in the meeting room?
In the world community.
In the world.
In the very local committee room.
We have a video.
I'm gonna start over. I'll try a different. Is there anybody in the committee room from either the legal community or the business community that wants to speak for or against this bill? Mr. Chairman, I'm a little concerned about this bill coming forward and being represented that it's really a good idea in the legal community, i.e. the Minnesota State Bar Association, is happy with the bill. I'm not seeing anybody from the business community coming forward and supporting this bill. My recollection going back to law school is a little different than that of Senator Latz. And I really am not seeing the reason or the benefit for this bill, given the fact that my recollection of corporate law is such that all of these ideas, in my mind, clearly can be taken into consideration and handled within the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws of a corporation. So I will indicate, Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, that I will not be supporting your bill.
Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to respond. In fact, I intended to, because I in reading facial expressions, I knew Senator Newman had some difficulty with it. Let me answer this your question, both pieces. First is about the business community. When we heard the policy of the bill in the Commerce Committee, we had numerous individuals who did run businesses. We had somebody from a foundation that talked about being able, you know, the desire to invest in something like this. So we did have some specific people at that at the Commerce Committee, businesses, because that's more where it is appropriate. And so we did have some there. And then secondly, I understand your discomfort. One of your reasons, I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that maybe this isn't necessary. You're saying that if this could be done on its own. And the challenge has been is that in a practical sense, it doesn't get done to the extent that would be beneficial to more people. And the reason is because a lot of it is about marketing. People have ingrained in their mind a certain expectations of a for-profit company and certain expectations of a nonprofit, and never the two shall meet. And that is where the gap is. And yes, you could do some, you know, I guess there's differing opinions as to how far you could go, and it becomes legal issues and about corporate organization and with the shareholders, but you still can make arguments about the gray area of it, and you could still have some some exposure to shareholder lawsuits and such. So this is to give that clarity to this, to say that if you freely choose to pursue this type of a business organization, that we want to make this available so that people can do that. If the only argument is against it is it's not necessary, well, there's a difference of opinion there. There are people saying that it is, and it certainly would not hurt. I'm not one for putting extra statute on the books that is not necessary. In this case, it has been made to me that this would be extraordinarily beneficial for those who wanted to pursue this and adding this clarity, and that's why I believe that, in fact, it is necessary.
Sir, no,
I don't know if I've swayed you or not. But.
No, you probably didn't, but you sure gave it a good shot. And I will tell you, Senator Gerlach, that I'm not so sure that the average person is going to understand the legal niceties and the differences between these different corporations. But I do think it would be their obligation, their responsibility, if you're going to be an investor in a corporation, to know and understand what that corporation is about. And those obligations, I believe, are listed in the bylaws in a corporation. I think they are listed in the articles of an incorporation. And if someone right now wanted to incorporate with the goals in mind that are listed in Senate File 1572, I sincerely believe they could do it right now without this legislation.
Senator Marty.
The only thing, Mr. Chair, that I'd add to the conversation, I think Senator Gerlach explained how there are a lot of businesses who feel this would be a better structure for them. And my only other addition would be that it's purely voluntary. You in starting your business or whatever, would have the choice of doing it this way or under 302A. It's not forced on anyone, and I understand your concern about the shareholders unknowingly doing this, but again, it would be listed as a different form of corporation, so that alone would tip them off. But it is purely voluntary, I'd stress.
Senator Newman?
The only comment I would make, Senator Marty, is it's also purely voluntary whether you enter into a nonprofit or a general partnership, an LLC, LLP. They're all voluntary.
Sir Gerlach, did you gain any assistance from the Bar Association when this bill was created?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, as I had said, that I received a memo from them with some technical advice. They neither support nor oppose, but offered some suggestions on how it could be improved, and we have made that attempt to accommodate those in the A1 amendment that we discussed previously.
All right. Thank you. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1572? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Oh,
I need a motion. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1572 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The amendment or the motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach.
To get Bermuda or A?
Senator Magnus.
What's it for? This?
Mr. Chair?
Sorry,
I should have asked, is this legislation that we just passed going to make any difference between bringing walleyes back and forth across the international borders?
Yes, it does. Do you want it to move it to Environment Committee?
Yes, I'd like to come to
right.
We could actually use a little extra.
The world community of walleyes, is that correct? Sir Magnus.
Hi, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to an exciting day in the Judiciary Committee.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman and members. And if we would have someone move the bill, this is the agriculture and rural economies policy bill.
That fits in my district, Mr.
I was Senator Latz will thinking be mine.
Thank you.
And Senator McGuire joining him.
Wants to second it. Okay. And then if someone, I do have before you the A7 amendment to try to get the bill into the shape we need to go as this moves forward. Ongoing discussions, and I know it's a lengthy amendment, but I have Mr. Knopf here from Senate Counsel to explain the amendment if you wish.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves A.
No, I have some questions on the amendment, if I could.
Oh, on the amendment.
Well, we don't move this fast.
We're not going to move this one fast, Senator Magnus.
I think Senator McGuire was going to move the amendment for.
I'll get it on the table, Mr. Chair.
I think we're going to recognize Senator Ingebrigtsen.
All right.
Mr. Chair, thank you. On the amendment lines 122, page 50, as well as 121, the definition of food, could we spend some time with that, or just some definition as to why the change there?
Mr. Chairman, I do have one change to the amendment. We want, it's our desire to delete line 1.16. Was not meant to be included in the amendment, so when we discuss the amendment, I would like to have that line deleted.
Why don't we do this? Senator McGuire will move the A7 amendment, and now we're into discussion, and Senator McGuire, would you wish to strike line 16 per the direction of Senator Magnus?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was worried you were going to have me describe the amendment.
That's fine. That'll come next. Senator McGuire moves that line 16 be struck. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Senator Ingebrigtsen. You had a question about...
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Was it line 21? Was it?
It was on the amendment, actually. So that would be page 50, line 26. The definition of food. The reason I asked the question, Mr. Chair and members, that most recently several policy bills, but the policy bill that pertained to definition of food with harvest whitetail deer. We had a venison donation program that we had some extensive discussion on, and I'm wondering if that plays any role here. I do see you have somebody from the Department of Ag here that maybe she could talk about that. Ms. Gaithier, is that correct? Does it pertain to anything? Mr. Knopf knows what I'm talking about. Does it pertain to the issue that I'm bringing up at all here in this particular bill?
Is there someone at the table that could answer Senator Ingebrigtsen's question? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this does not
could
affect...
You identify yourself for the record.
Greg Knopf, Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis.
Mr. Knopf, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this just puts back the lines you're talking about on 1.22, 1.23. This puts back the definition of adulteration to where it is currently under the food law. What it does is... This amendment does three things. Maybe could I explain the amendment just real briefly? There are three things the amendment does.
That'd be fine. Go ahead.
One is to take sections out of the bill that would otherwise have to be seen in state government, causing the bill not to make deadline. And it also, those are two things. There's a dairy research cooperative provision that's being deleted in lines 1.2 to 1.5. In 1.7, there was an extension of the Food Safety Task Force. That's being deleted on line 1.7. And 1.6 and 1.5 through 1.28 are all related to removing feed from this new food law enforcement chapter. So feed will remain separate. You'll have a food, human consumption food law will be enforced all in one chapter, and feed will remain as it is under current law. And then on 1.8 through 1.14, those are some technical amendments that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture asked to have in the amendment. So there's really kind of three parts. One is to delete the state government operations, Minnesota Department of Agriculture technical, and then the remainder of the amendment is to basically put the feed law back the way it was, and to keep feed in it, enforcement of feed laws in the same chapter that it is now. The parts that you're talking about on 1.22 to 1.23, this just puts it back. Instead of saying human or animal, it just says for health, and that's what the current law says for adulteration. So that's all that does, and this does not affect any hunter-harvested venison, as Senator Ingebrigtsen's other bill has relates to.
Thank you for that short answer.
Yep.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that I've moved this amendment, I'm understanding it. Did you say one of these sections we're deleting is about food safety? And could you just expand on that a bit? I hate to be authoring an amendment that deleted food safety provision.
Right. And Mr. Chair and Senator Mr. McGuire, it's line 1.7 of the amendment. There's a food safety task force that will expire this summer. And this bill does contain an extension of that. But if we keep that in here, this bill is required to go to state government information. And with it's one of those things where I think we might be able to pick it up later. I think the House bill is in their state government committee. The thought was to remove it now so that we could make deadline with it today.
Thank Mr. Chair, I would just go on record that I hope you do that then. I mean, I hope that that stays, that comes back in then.
We will.
Any other questions on the amendment? Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you
I would move that.
Get your answer
yes.
satisfied? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, agriculture and rural policy bill. I would just point out the sections of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that we would anticipate the Judiciary Committee would have interest in. The first section is Section 4, page 4, subdivision 10, I believe, dealing with indemnification. And this is allowing a local unit of government acting in a joint powers agreement to handle waste pesticide collection. I have with me Ms. Greta Goth here from the department to explain that.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gothier. I'm Director of Government Relations at the Department of Agriculture. Section 4, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is a provision that is supported by the Association of Minnesota Counties, and it is similar to language that is in under the purview of the Pollution Control Agency now. So it would bring us into conformance with the existing statute. And what it would do is indemnify the haulers, or the, well, let me back up. In 1989, the Groundwater Protection Act gave our department the responsibility of collecting all ag and non-ag waste pesticide and gave us the authority to contract with counties to collect ag and non-ag waste pesticide as a part of the county's household hazardous waste collection. So we would be kind of piggybacking on their household hazardous waste collection. We have now entered into contracts with 51 counties to do that, and 10 other counties where they collect the non-ag waste pesticide. So when you think of non-ag waste pesticide, think of structural applications to buildings, for example, for bed bugs maybe, or that sort of thing. And then we have 26 counties with whom we have not entered into a contract yet. But we would like to. We believe it's more efficient for us as an agency to enter into contracts and have the pesticide waste collected with the household hazardous waste. So this section, and also, Mr. Chairman, a little bit further on, another section that I believe will also relates to this, are some provisions that will enable us to work with the remaining 26 counties and try to forge agreements with as many as possible to go ahead and collect ag and non-ag waste pesticide as part of their household hazardous waste. In this section here, there's a indemnification of the counties by the states for the period of time when they are hauling the waste to its final destination, whether that's another local unit or whether that's a storage or disposal site.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then the next section that we would point out is section 14 through 27, starting on the bottom of page 7, going into page 8, where we have a new language for enforcement and civil liabilities, duties of the commissioners, and so on.
Sir Magnus, can I interrupt you just one second? Is there any questions on section 4 that come from the committee? All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, sections 14 through 26, starting on the bottom of page 7. We're talking here about providing for the inspection enforcement of laws relating to wholesale produce dealers, grain buyers, warehouses, and grain storage under the current Minnesota Department of Agriculture powers for plant protection and nurseries.
Do you want to explain, or would you like to? Or?
I can, if you want to.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Knopf.
Yeah, basically what this does is, you know, they have current authority for plant protection and tree nurseries, and what this does is it puts these additional chapters under that same under those same enforcement powers. So there aren't new powers granted here, but there will be new chapters of law that will be enforced under those powers that exist for other parts of the agency.
Senator Magnus, did you say that, yes, section 16 under civil liability on page 8, lines 9 through 11, there is a reference on civil liability to specific chapters. Could you tell me what you're trying to accomplish in that regard for Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Chapter 27 is wholesale produce dealers, and then 223, 231, and 232 are grain buyers, warehouses, and grain storage.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
All right. Mr. Chairman, then the next section is section 66 on wind easements. What we're doing with that is extending a sunset day. Basically, the way the statutes are now, a wind developer and a local landowner would have are under the requirement that you have a 7-year period during any wind easement agreements. You have a 7-year period to either build it or not, and your easement ends. And so it's a use it or lose it provision. And Mr. Chairman and members, folks are realizing that when they're attempting to do some land transactions, mortgage some land, perhaps do this sort of thing, all of a sudden these easements pop up and they can cause some concern. And so what we're doing is recognizing that it does take a period of time, Mr. Chairman, to get a power purchase agreement, go through the all the agreements, the state and federal, to get new wind projects going, but we want to continue a program that's worked very well, saying we have a 7-year limit. You either build on it or you don't. Someone else can come in and negotiate another agreement if you wish. So it's a use it or lose it provision that we're just extending out in time.
And you're extending it 5 years?
Yes.
Does this require that this bill would go to the Regulated Industry Committee?
We heard this bill in agriculture. We heard it in Energy Committee,
right.
And Energy was that Senator Brown's bill. Energy moved it to the consent calendar. We're just waiting for House action, and if they don't take action, we'll have it in the bill here, and it will be in the House Agriculture Policy Bill too, just to make sure we extend this provision that is non-controversial at all.
All right, please continue.
Thank you.
Is there any questions so far? Please
then the next provision we would point out, Mr. Chair and members, is Article 2, again dealing with food enforcement, as Senator McGuire talked about, Section 31, page 54. Again, I'll have Mr. Knopf or Ms. Gauthier explain this. What we're doing is this under these provisions. Mr. Knopf, probably.
Mr. Chair and members, what this does is it puts enforcement of all food laws for humans in one chapter. It's transferring it over. And the enforcement powers that are granted here are similar to what you have for the pesticide and fertilizer enforcement. It's also very similar to, in fact, it's the same as what you saw earlier for the nurseries and plant protection, and we're adding the chapters on grains and warehouses. It's similar authority. They'd have similar authority for food as they do under those chapters. They do have enforcement powers now, but this is just transferring that power over to this new chapter and being very clear and also kind of modeling after that authority in the pesticide and fertilizer enforcement law. Gives them the civil actions, injunctions, criminal actions. It basically, if you look on page 55, you can see the various authority that is granted here. I don't know how much more you want to go into all of this. The remainder of these sections that you'll see on your summary of the judiciary provisions deal with administrative actions. They do have a current authority for administrative penalty. They have administrative action authority right now. They have administrative penalty authority right now, although I think this is a little bit higher. They also have the appeal of administrative actions. The two really new things here are the civil penalties. They have civil penalties for pesticides and fertilizers, and they have civil penalties for nurseries and plant protection, but they have not had civil penalty authority for food violations. And so Section 36 will provide those civil penalties. And under the criminal penalties, you'll see that there are some violations for endangering humans and knowing violations that are elevated to gross misdemeanors. It's my understanding that those are not current law. And then you also have the powers of the commissioner for investigations, Section 39. I don't know if you want any more of an explanation or the department could explain why they're doing some of these things.
Any questions on this area? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 55, line 16, under criminal actions, it indicates that when the commissioner reports a violation, the county attorney shall institute the appropriate proceedings. And that, excuse me, appears to be a mandatory provision upon an elected official. Usually the county attorney is the individual who makes the call as to whether or not criminal proceedings are to be initiated. And I simply question whether it's appropriate to allow a commissioner to require a county attorney to initiate criminal proceedings.
Ms. Gauthier, we think it...
Ms.
No, go ahead.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman. You're referring to... this is our general enforcement, and I believe that, Mr. Chairman, this is already in current law. What we have done in this Article 2 of the bill is to take the enforcement language from a number of different statutes that grew up over time as the food industry changed. The legislature gave our agency authority to start regulating for food safety in 1889. So we have made numerous, as you can imagine, have had changes in technology, changes in processing, changes in communication. I mean, over time, many different statutes grew up. And what we're trying to do here is to consolidate the enforcement in one place. So the provisions under Section 31 here are already existing in the law elsewhere, and we've merely moving them to one spot so that it is easier for those in the public and in the industry to find what the enforcement requirements are, to find them in the statute, to understand them. And also we hope, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, it will make it easier for us to enforce them thus allowing us to reduce some costs or at least streamline our efforts, Mr. Chairman. So my understanding is all of that language currently exists.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Be that as it may, and I appreciate the fact you're moving some statutes and bringing things up to date. That really wasn't the point that I was trying to make. I'm certainly not in any way trying to intimate that the commissioner shouldn't have the responsibility to look into food safety and pesticide safety and et cetera. My question is, and I guess this would be more to the committee than to the testifiers, is it appropriate to have the commissioner of a state agency in a position to require a county attorney who is an elected official to institute criminal proceedings? That's my question. Whether it's in current law or not. And my position would be, I don't think, you know, I could see it, that they may institute, but I think it's the county attorney's call, not the commissioner's.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an interesting question, Senator Newman. So I was going to ask counsel if this is patterned after any other statute where we direct a county attorney, you know, where a state agency would direct a county attorney to prosecute. I appreciate that we do want county attorneys to have discretion, but I'm curious if there's any other
places. McGuire, maybe Mr. Knopf can tell us.
Who can answer that?
Yeah. A reference to this.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, and Senator McGuire particularly, one of the repealed provisions is in the current food law, and it says it shall be the duty of each county attorney or senator to whom the commissioner reports any violation of the Minnesota food law to cause appropriate proceedings. So it is an existing law for food right now. We're just recodifying it into a new chapter.
And Mr. Chairman, it also, on line 5519, there is a provision in there if the county or city attorney refuses to prosecute, that the attorney general, on request of the commissioner, may prosecute this provision.
But Mr. Senator Magnus, yeah. the operative word was may that you just mentioned, and Senator Newman is bringing up the shall that's in your proposal.
Mr. Chair, the current food law does say shall, and this is what they've done is they've repackaged this similar to what we have in the pesticide law. The pesticide and fertilizer law also says they shall prosecute.
Right. Sir Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I share Senator Newman's concerns, and maybe now I've got some other laws to be concerned about, too.
I already have in place, Mr. Chair. Yes.
I mean, I've not heard before of any mandate on a prosecuting authority to initiate legal proceedings. It says, to whom the commission reports any violation. So what will be causing appropriate proceedings to be initiated will be the report of a violation. I don't know what appropriate proceedings means. Does it mean no proceedings if the violation can't be proved? What exactly does that? That's a little ambiguous there. I'd prefer may there, and I'll move to delete shall and replace it with may and 55.17.
Okay. Senator Letts, I'm going to ask counsel to weigh in here before we get to your motion.
Sure.
Ms. Pontius, could you make a comment regarding, or is it Mr. Backus? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know have anything particularly new to add. I think, you know, I have seen sentences or provisions like this in other areas of the law. I guess I'm guessing that a prosecutor would probably ignore this if they didn't think charges were appropriate. And I think when it says on line 17, appropriate proceedings, as Senator Letts mentioned, that does seem to introduce some type of discretion, even though it's a shell institute. And then the second sentence does anticipate situations in which the prosecutors refuse to prosecute, in which case the Attorney General may prosecute.
Mr. Chairman,
Sir Letts.
I'll defer to Senator Newman.
Given the explanation of Mr. Backus, it's almost as though line 0.19 and 20 regarding the Attorney General is in conflict with the requirement of this county attorney to initiate appropriate proceedings. When I initiate appropriate proceedings, what I see is the county attorney being required to initiate a criminal action, which is what Subdivision 5 is all about. And I think that Mr. Backus has raised a really an interesting question. He says, well, I think that the county attorney would probably just ignore this situation. What an impossible position to put a county attorney in. By statute, by law, he is ordered to do something and say, well, I'm not going to do it. And so I would support Senator Latz's motion to substitute the word may for shall for the reasons that I've been describing.
Council has a suggestion. Ms. Pioneer.
Mr. Chair, members, I was also looking at the without delay language on line, page 55, line 18. So, I don't know if you want to delete that, too.
Yes. I'll add that to my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
All right. On the amendment, Senator Murdy.
Mr. Chair, I kind of like they may do this immediately upon.
And without delay.
Without delay. Mr. Chair, I realize this is an existing law, but and it does sound to me like if the county attorney doesn't want to do it, they're going to say, well, we'll institute appropriate proceedings, and this is a technical thing or a minor thing, and so appropriate is nothing. We'll do that appropriate nothing without delay, but I have a feeling prosecutors do find a way out of it, but I think it's smarter to leave it up to their discretion in the end. And frankly, if they refuse to prosecute, which it's already envisioning, the backup is the Attorney General, who also may prosecute. So I think this is making it consistent with what the backup is. It's an optional thing.
Sir Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm wrong, but I think this, you know, as this is in statute elsewhere, as they've already talked about, my fear of going someplace else with this, does this not just require the county attorney to look at the case?
Senator.
And if he decides, or he or she decides not to look at it, then it would go from there to the Attorney General?
It appears, Senator Ingebrigtsen, by the wording, that this law would order the county attorney to institute proceedings in court and prosecute. Doesn't say they
doesn't
use
give them
their judgment. But I want to bring your attention to the language that's being repealed in this bill in reference to this, 31.14, duty to prosecute. The repealed law says something just subtly different. It shall be the duty of each county attorney or city attorney to whom the commissioner reports any violation of Minnesota food law to cause appropriate proceedings. It's not that they shall prosecute. It's simply defining, this is the proposal that they're repealing, the duty description. It shall be the duty of each county attorney. It says, county attorney to whom the commissioner reports any violation shall institute proceedings in the proper courts. So they're repealing the duty description of the county attorney and replacing it with the shall language, as in the language that we're talking about. And Senator Latz wants to make it more of a discretionary call on the part of the prosecutor with the word may.
But it would still, Mr. Chair? Would it still force the decision to the county attorney? It still would force them to look at it, and then that person would make that decision, correct? Not compelling them to either prosecute. They can say no, and then if that's not satisfactory, they can go from there to the Attorney General's office. Isn't that what it says?
No. counsel is saying to your first question, yes, the county attorney would have to bring attention to it, but it's at his discretion whether he would prosecute.
With the amendment.
With the amendment. Senator Latz's amendment, if it was agreed upon. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm agreeing with Senator Ankerbritzen that I'm a little concerned that if we just say may, they actually wouldn't have to even address them. I mean, I don't know what requires them to address them. If you have I'm sure this doesn't happen very often, if ever, that a county attorney would disregard recommendations by the commissioner, by a department, but they just don't agree with what they're doing, and so they would choose to not address any of the violations that would come before them, because we just have this very voluntary language. That means that it would all then just go to the Attorney General. I'm saying that maybe we have a shall review it, but I guess that's just saying look at it, and then if they don't do anything, it may not be adding a whole lot of meat to it. But I would really like the county attorneys to feel that they should at least review it.
Senator Magnus?
Well, Mr. Chair,
tell us what's,
we have federal food laws also. And then when you look at the interstate movement of food, which is, minute-by-minute occurrence, we need to have the Attorney General position in place when you're doing, dealing with these federal laws and the interstate movement of products, because you'll have cases where the Attorney General has to come up and rectify the situation, that you wouldn't have the county attorney's desire to do that. But I think we may have a suggestion for language that would help with the committee's concerns. Mr. Knopf has been brainstorming this a little bit for us.
Mr. Backus has been brainstorming, too. Yeah. He might have some suggestions. Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know what Mr. Knopf has considered, but we had been talking about potentially saying shall consider instituting appropriate proceedings in the proper courts and prosecuting them in the manner required by law. That would clearly require the prosecutor to at least consider and then it preserve their discretion.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Mr. Backus?
Tell us what line and page you're on.
I'm confused.
Page 55. Yeah. Line 17, delete shall and insert, after shall, insert consider, and then delete institute and put instituting. So shall consider instituting appropriate proceedings in the proper courts, and then on line 18, delete prosecute and insert prosecuting.
Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Newman?
Is the words without delay?
That would be out.
That is out.
Mr. Chair, I was kind of building that into this based on the prior conversation, but yes.
This was actually Senator Latz's amendment, oral amendment. Have you been following Senator Latz
yes.
on that?
I agree with Mr. Backus.
All right.
Are we taking
Senator Magnus or Mr. Knopf?
Let's have Mr. Knopf state his, and then you folks decide which ones you all like, right. Or maybe a combination.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, I was looking at the pesticide fertilizer and the nursery law. Currently, in there, we would just say that they're responsible. So what the amendment would be is delete shall institute, insert is responsible for instituting, and then on line 55.18, and delete prosecute, insert prosecuting. So it would be is responsible rather than shall. So the responsibility is on them, and then if they refuse, then the Attorney General steps in.
Mr.
Senator Newman?
I would refer Mr. Bax's language. The county attorney already has the responsibility for charging out appropriate criminal charges, and to put in is responsible to me would be ambiguous as to whether or not it's mandatory or not. So I would prefer Mr. Bax's language.
Senator Latz?
I agree.
All right. Any further discussion? Would counsel repeat the amendment one last time?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 55, line 17, after shall, actually delete institute and insert consider instituting. And then on line 18, delete without delay, and then delete prosecute and insert prosecuting. So it would read, each county attorney or city attorney to whom the commissioner reports any violation of this chapter shall consider instituting appropriate proceedings in the proper courts and prosecuting them in the manner required by law.
Does everyone understand the amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think technically I'll withdraw my amendment and I'll offer another amendment as stated by Mr. Backus.
All right. Senator Latz offers the amendment described by Mr. Backus. Question, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, if so, I wonder if the next sentence, if the county or city attorney refuses to prosecute, might be better appropriate language to conform with the amendment, to chooses not to prosecute because they have not. I mean, the law is the draft, the bill as it came in here was kind of mixed up because it sort of implies that, of course, a lot of them are going to refuse to do what we're telling them they have to do. And we're, in effect, saying we're not asking, we're just asking you to, requiring you to consider it. And if you then choose not to prosecute, then the Attorney General may prosecute.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
If you choose not to prosecute, aren't you refusing to prosecute?
Sure, I'm just saying, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that it's kind of like I refuse to go eat lunch. It's more I'm choosing not to go eat lunch.
But if you don't,
that's okay.
But if you don't, you're refusing
that's
to go.
Fine.
Yeah, which is actually getting quite close, actually. Yeah.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen owes me lunch, so I'm getting hungry too.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear what the author thinks of that amendment.
Senator Magnus.
Well, I think we're in agreement with it. What we were trying to do is have a uniform language between the statutes, so the department. That's what we're trying to do with the whole bill, really. And so we were trying to match the language up with our amendment here to what the other statutes language the other statutes has in them but again I would point out I agree that with the amendment suggested by council there, we're still accomplishing what we want to do under the Federal Food Act with interstate movements and so on. We're still accomplishing everything that we're desiring in the bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair, is this going to be in conflict with other statutes? Is that what I'm hearing from you, Senator, that's going to open up a can here?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is that they've modeled this after their current enforcement authority now. So if they find a violation under the pesticide or fertilizer law or under the nursery and seed law, they would it would be phrased differently there. Under those chapters, it would say that the county attorney is responsible for prosecuting. And under this law now, it would say shall consider instituting. So I don't know how much different. I mean, but all I'm saying is it would be different because under current law, under those chapters, it would be worded differently. And the county attorney would treat it differently or could treat it differently.
Any further discussion? Sir Marty, did you want to proceed with your amendment to the
Mr. Chair, no, mine was just, I think it would read better that way, but it's kind of like the difference between what Mr. Knopf is suggesting and the amendment we're looking at here. I think it's 601, half dozen the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, county attorneys are going to be using their best judgment, and if they choose or refuse or whatever to prosecute, the department's going to go to the Attorney General, and they will either choose or refuse to prosecute.
All right. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, I apologize. I'm just walking back in the middle of this. Is the current amendment leaving it to prosecutorial discretion, or is it mandatory? Because if it's mandatory, I'm wondering about the fiscal note in terms of additional prosecutions that would be laid on either the Attorney General's office or the county attorneys.
Senator Latz, to the question. your amendment would allow county attorneys to use discretion in prosecuting rather than being ordered to prosecute in all cases.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Everyone understands the Ladd's oral amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail. Any further discussion on Senate File 2061? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Senator McGuire, did you have a question?
Just procedurally, Mr. Chair, just remind us, is this going from here now to the floor? Is that where this is going? And then it'll get lined up with the House in conference committee. I want to make sure that food safety provision gets back in.
Yep.
That's where that will happen.
Absolutely.
And just for the record, want to make sure that can happen.
Senator McGuire moves Senate File 2061 as amended.
I was just moving the amendment, Mr. Chair. Someone else can actually move the bill if they'd like.
We did not do the amendment?
No, we didn't.
We did.
Oh, did we already do the amendment? Oh, then I don't know that I moved the bill itself, did I? Or did Senator Ladd tonight?
Happy to move the bill if we're done with the amendment.
Yes, okay. We are. Senator Harrington moves Senate File 2061 as amended to be recommended to pass to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion does prevail.
Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
You,
Chairman.
Senator.
Thank you.
I know. I actually
have a final. Senator Ortman.
That's why I need the amendment.
It does have some impact on you.
Yeah, right.
I think I used to have horses at some point down in Battle Creek.
Sure. Senator Ortman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have asked for a hearing on Senate File 639, a pretty straightforward bill. I have a constituent that has been advocating at the Capitol for more than a year now.
Senator Ortman, we're on House File 795. It's probably the same language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 795. My constituent has a child support order against her divorced husband and the father of her children. She can't enforce it here in Minnesota. His assets are in Bermuda. She has gone all the way to the State Department to ask for help in enforcing this child support order. The State Department can't help her because there is no national reciprocity agreement between the United States and Bermuda. What we've learned from the State Department is that when there's enough support at the state level to establish a national policy of reciprocity, then they move forward. We don't have enough states yet that have reciprocity with Bermuda. So we're asking that Minnesota be added, establish our own relationship of reciprocity so that she can go then and take a court order from Minnesota to Bermuda and attempt to enforce that order against a former Minnesotan with assets in Bermuda. This has passed the House. We actually passed it last year. It's been tucked into a couple of different omnibus bills, and for whatever reason, it has not yet passed. And so I would ask that this be sent separately to the floor. There is an A1 amendment. It was drafted with a 2012 application last year, and so I'd like to change the date on line 1.12 from December 31 to 2012 to 2013, and that would be reflected in the A1 amendment, and I would move the adoption of the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman moves the A1 amendment. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment does prevail.
Thank you. If there are any questions
on the bill? Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, only question is, has this ever been done with any other country? I mean, I'm just curious if child support things, pictures, not just Bermuda, but have you heard of any others?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services is here. Human Services. She can testify.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Martineau with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I'm not sure exactly what your question was.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Marty.
Simply, are there other countries where we have people trying to enforce child support orders? Have we ever done this before and other countries have cooperated, or have we done legislation like this, or we just have not enforced it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty,
yes, Marty.
The United States has reciprocal agreements with a number of foreign countries. They don't have one with Bermuda, but states can enter into their own reciprocal agreements. I would point out, however, that the agreement, it doesn't mean that we can use our laws in that country. Their laws would prevail.
Any other discussion? Senator Newman.
Senator Ortman, what kind of procedures are we requiring the commissioner to initiate? I mean, can you procedurally give me an idea as to what we're dealing with or what we're talking about?
Ms. Martineau.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, the Attorney General would send a letter asking to enter into a reciprocal agreement with the department, corresponding department in Bermuda, and await their response.
Committee could go down and check on it.
Senator Newman.
This isn't going to wind up in, you know, a lawsuit or, you know, enforcement proceedings or anything. It's just what we're doing here is opening up discussions with the country of Bermuda on this issue. Am I understanding correctly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, yes, that's correct.
Is there a fiscal note on this, Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of one.
I thought we don't even have coverage for the field trip to Bermuda. We have to make a factually informed decision, don't we?
Mr. Chair, I have not yet been able to arrange any kind of a field trip connected to this legislation.
All right. Any other discussion?
Oh.
I tried.
Mr. Chair, I want to know what's going on this committee today.
John, it's John. John's
got control. It's humor and sarcasm. Uh-huh.
Well, we don't allow humor on this committee.
Oh, no, so that's for sure.
Sarcasm.
Mr. Chair, did this bill have to go to the Department of Ag Committee, too?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, that would be a first for me. I don't think I have ever been before the Ag Committee. That's one committee I've never been to before, so please don't jinx me now. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House File 795 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Senator Ortman, move Senate File. House File 795 be recommended to pass as amended and move to possibly the consent calendar. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Members and Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you,
thank you.
We didn't know we did House Files.
Why don't we do the number 9?
It doesn't matter.
We needed this one.
Better stick around with this. Because it's another country.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Mr. Backus a question about this bill we just passed while they're conferring? Thanks, Mr. Chair. Do we need to give them authority? Why do they need authority for such a department? I was just curious. I don't have any trouble with this bill.
Yeah.
Did they have? They couldn't just do this on their own. Obviously, is that correct?
They do need authority to do it.
Pardon me?
Or direction from the state.
Regarding.
I was just asking.
She hasn't been recognized yet.
While you were conferring with Senator Limmer, I was just asking counsel a question.
Senator Limmer, you wanted to bring up.
Why don't we do number 8 on the agenda?
Number 8?
Senate File 2295.
Okay, Senate File 2295 is before us. To your bill, Senator Limmer.
For Senate File 2295 is making reference to a cross-reference We had this discussion earlier this year regarding the community notification when a patient leaves civil commitment and is moving or transferring to a halfway house. We had that discussion in the committee, and during that discussion we found a cross-reference that needed to be added to that Senate file. When it got to the House, they moved the House file, not the Senate file, and our cross-reference was omitted. So this is catching up to that and correcting it and making sure that cross-reference is included.
Any questions? Senator Marty.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this is a technical change to the bill we passed a couple weeks ago?
That's correct.
Senator Limmer. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, just procedurally, are we having an omnibus judiciary bill, or no, are you going to pass all this separately?
We've had a collection of all sorts of bills. Probably not an omnibus one will be this year.
So these will just be going on their own?
This is just on the community notification regarding when a patient leaves, let's say, St. Peter and is moving to a halfway house. It's the same cross-reference that we all voted on before. It just, when it got to the floor, the House file was moved.
Any further discussions on Senate File 2295? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Mr. Chair?
Oops.
Chair, could I move Senate File 2295?
Yes.
Be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
And Senator Limmer, would you like this to go on the consent calendar, perchance?
Yes.
Senator Limmer has moved Senate File 2295 to the recommended pass and go to the floor on the consent calendar. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 2464 is a bill brought to us by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm going to allow them to describe the bill.
To the testifier, please state your name and welcome to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelly Mitchell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The purpose of Senate File 2464 is to allow the commission to make a technical correction to the sex offender grid. I think you all have in your packets a letter from the commission that was issued today, and that explains it a little bit further. But what happened is the sex offender grid sets forth sentencing for all sex offenses. And the grid is arranged so that on the one side you have the severity level of the offense, and on the other side you have the criminal history score. For each cell within that grid, there's a presumptive sentence. And by law, we are allowed to also include in that cell a range that the judge can order without departure that's 15% below that presumptive sentence or 20% above the presumptive sentence. When we created the grid in 2006 and we did the math to calculate those ranges, we used the rounding rules that everyone learned in grade school, which is if you get a decimal place, a number that's 0.5 or greater, you round up, and if you get a number that's 0.4 or below, you round down. But the result of doing that on this grid is that we now have some ranges that are greater than the 15% below or 20% up that's allowed by law. So what we want to do is go back and use our own rounding rules so that we would always round down if we get 0.5 or above and round up if we get something lower than that, so that those ranges that are on the grid are right within that 15% down and 20% up that you allow us to have by law. Now, the way that our enabling legislation works is whenever we make a change to the grid, we have to bring it to you in our report that's filed in January, and if you don't act otherwise, then it becomes effective in August. So that means for us that we can't correct the grid until August 1 of 2013. And what we're asking you to do is to authorize us to go ahead and correct it now and then issue it immediately so that we don't continue to have these sentencing errors pronounced in court. So with that, I'll take any questions if that's clear as mud.
Ms. Mitchell.
Actually, it's scary.
Ms. Mitchell, in or on line 8 of the bill.
On line 8?
Of the bill. It indicates that acting without a public hearing. Can you tell me specifically what it is that you would be doing that would be acting without a public hearing?
So under our administrative rules, the rules that govern the way that the commission does its work, whenever we make any change, we are required to hold a public hearing or give 60 days notice to the public that the change will occur, hold a public hearing, and then we can actually put those changes into effect. So we're asking that since we're making a technical change to the grid that actually brings it in line with the law as it exists today, and we're not changing sentencing to something that's new, we're asking that we be able to make that change without going through our public hearing process. That would allow us to actually put the grid out, you know, almost immediately after this bill is signed by the governor rather than having to wait until sometime this summer.
And the specifically the proposition that you are trying to do with this grid is to make the rounding up, rounding down correction without the public hearing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And what you are doing then would be bringing the sentencing grid into conformity with the Blakely case. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, because on the upper end of the range for all of those sentences that are 1 month too great on the top end of the range, that's an aggravated departure that's been imposed without the benefit of the Blakely procedure. So we would like to eliminate that possibility so that it is the grid does comply with Blakely.
And Ms. Mitchell, the correction that we are authorizing you to do with this bill to do without a public hearing is, and I just want to make sure that I'm on board with you here, is that this is a one-time authority to correct the grid. This is not an ongoing issue. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, you are correct. That is our understanding of this bill.
And then could you finally, Ms. Mitchell, I notice on page 2 of the letter we've got in the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, the court may correct at any time a sentence not authorized by law, et cetera. Could you talk to us a little bit about procedurally how these sentencing corrections are going to occur?
Mr. Chair, for the individuals who have been sentenced since the grid went into effect in 2006, there are about 67 who received a sentence that's at the top end of the range. So 67 individuals who have 1 month too long on their sentence. And so I've contacted the State Court Administrator's office and told them that we have already identified all of the individuals who've been impacted by this error and that we would like to work with them to provide that information to the original sentencing judges so that they can go back and correct that sentence. As a commission, the commission obviously can't tell a judge that that's what they have to do, but that's going to be our very strong recommendation, and we're working with staff in the State Court Administrator's office to develop procedures to make it very easy for the judges to do that once they get this information.
And so procedurally what's going to happen, Ms. Mitchell, is we are going to correct the error that was made in the 67 sentences in the past. And then going forward, we won't have that mistake any longer, and that's the whole purpose of what's going on here.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your questions. I wanted similar clarifications, but when you now tell the judges that they've over-sentenced by a month, then they can correct it. Remind me, what if they don't want to correct it? What are the... If they deviate from the grid, I think they're allowed to do it, right? Do they just have to give a reason to deviate from the grid, or are they not allowed to deviate from the grid? Remind me what judges are supposed to do with this grid.
Ms. Mitchell.
And what we're going to do if they choose not to fix it, as they'll be asked to do.
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, under the rules of criminal procedure, the court can do a mitigated departure on its own. but it cannot do an aggravated departure on its own. The prosecution has to initiate that under the new Blakely procedures. So we do kind of have this situation where it's an illegal sentence. Now, if the court chooses not to view it that way and decides not to amend the sentence, to sort of have a stopgap measure, we're providing the same information to the public defenders and the prosecutors in these cases. So the public defender could bring a motion for resentencing. So if the court doesn't act on its own, there'll be a somebody, you know, second in line that can then bring a motion to get that case corrected and at a minimum to have all that process occur if the desire is to uphold the sentence. I think that my guess would be that the courts would take the easier path and just reduce that sentence by a month.
Any further questions? Any more discussion? Seeing none, Senator Limmer, my instructions are is that this bill is supposed to go to state government. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2464 be recommended to pass and move to state government.
All those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion is adopted. You're on your way to state government.
There's no further business before the committee. Hey.
We are therefore adjourned.
Lunchtime.
This didn't.
Safety and Ron Latton not sharing any.